Who knows more about Munster rugby, me or you, Quinny?
Everyone has an opinion, don't they? Some of the opinions are waffle, but I'd like to think I know a lot.
The Red 78 with Alan Quinlan and Niamh Briggs. Subscribe to the Rugby Channel on the OTB Sports app and turn on your notifications now.
OTB AM. With Gillette. Put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.
All right, it's bang on 7:30. It's Wednesday morning. You're very welcome along to the show. If you'd like to get involved in any of the conversations we're having this morning, and I think you know what we're going to be talking about, then you can get us on 0879 180 180. Or, of course, you can use the hashtag OTBAM on Twitter. You can leave a comment on the YouTube stream. Owen is here.
Hey, Ger.
I think Nathan is here as well. Nathan, good morning to you.
Good morning, lads.
Mayor voting no, are they? What's going on? You're The heavyweight political power that is you arguing in favour of Plan B, Prop B, it didn't work.
Well, I was listening to James Horan. He seems to have the same old issue that a lot of people do about the team in sixth place, playing all these massive games week in, week out, and you might miss out on points difference. And the old team in Division 4 who's cruised through, you know, beating London and beating Leitrim, that they get to play in an All-Ireland series. Mayo aren't happy about that. Mayo are, you know, a late summer team, depending on what months of summer, you're talking about. Mayo are a late summer team, so they're a bit worried, I expect, about that.
Monaghan has never felt so loved as a county.
Yeah.
Like, everybody...
Everyone assuming that Monaghan are going to finish sixth.
All of a sudden, just it has the future of Monaghan on this pedestal. The future of the rest of the country. Forget about that. It doesn't matter if Division 4 gets cast aside and they've got no avenue into the All-Ireland Series whatsoever. We need to make sure that people in Monaghan aren't too pissed off if they avoid relegation by the skin of their teeth and all of a sudden they're not getting through to the next round. We must protect Monaghan. Vote no on Saturday, everyone.
It is a weird old scenario, isn't it? Where we've all got into a sexed up version of the GA political world.
Am I the only one who thinks that the Division 4 team getting into the All-Ireland Series is actually the best part of this?
Well, there's a wildcard element to it that actually switches on the whole country.
100%.
It's like a switch. Oh, we're in this.
But it also means that you start the season, firstly, every team can say they have a chance of winning Sam Maguire, even though we know that probably 25 of them don't have a chance in hell of winning Sam Maguire. But the most likely scenario is the Division 4 team, say next year it's Andy Moran at Leitrim and they go and they win Division 4 and you've got momentum and you're playing a Kildare. And Kildare, you know, as usual, could you really trust them on the big day? If Leitrim beat Kildare, like, that is one of the stories of the summer. All right, then they go on and probably play Kerry or Dublin in All-Ireland quarterfinal and you get beaten out the park. But they get beaten out the park in the first round of the Connacht Championship every year. But this way, you've just won a league. You've just had one of the greatest days in your county's history by beating Kildare, and you're going to have that massive occasion, albeit with an all probable result in the bag against Kerry or Dublin. But that's what it should be about.
100%. And we actually saw a scenario very close to that a couple of years ago when Kildare got taken out by Carlow. Now, in fairness, I don't think Carlow won Division 4 that year, but I think they got promoted from Division 4 that year. The chances are the team that finished second and third in Division 2 are just the right amount of flaky to be susceptible to a defeat like that. And I'm sure Kildare are going to stay in Division 1 and they're never going to be flaky ever again. But whoever replaces Kildare as that team over the next little while in the sort of the yo-yo team.
Roscommon.
Like, I mean, they are susceptible to getting beaten by a Derry from Division 3 or a Cavanagh or Tipperary in next year's case.
Yeah.
Like, I think that the conditions are there for an upset to happen because you're coming up against a team, an underdog, that has won six or seven games out of a possible seven. So, yeah, like I think that has potential to surprise a few people, that little wrinkle in this format.
We'll come back to this a little bit later on in a bit more detail. Go on, if you had one more point there, Nathan.
I was going to say again, doesn't it all just work perfectly though? Because if it's a Roscommon against the Leitrim, and Roscommon have had a decent league campaign, and actually they are building something, that they have a game against Leitrim where they warm up nicely, they win that game, and then they kick on and they play one of the better teams in Division 1 in the All-Ireland quarterfinal. But again, everything is set up for Roscommon to go into that game at the peak of their powers.
Yeah, or at least on some form of even footing where they've had the exact same number of games as each other, where when you win this, you will have won the same amount of games, give or take one, as everybody else who entered the competition, as opposed to some teams who get a bye to a provincial semi-final, win their provincial final, and then next year are going to win a quarter-final, semi-final. You'll have won five games to win All-Ireland, whereas some other team will have to win eight games. I mean, the baked-in unfairness of the provincial championships, the thing that they're all trying to protect, that they're scratching and clawing to protect, It makes no sense. It just makes no sense. And, you know, those of us in one specific camp are being accused of spin and bluster in the papers this morning. Like, oh, my God. It's getting to the point where I was Googling the FRC, right, who were the original ones who came up with the black car. That was Eugene McGee's most recent crowd in, and they had two reports, and the first one was the black card, and actually the second report was the one that moved the minor championship from under 18 to under 17 and also made a calendar year for the club championships, which has eventually happened. It got through, and it took a long time for it to actually happen, and then it did happen. And and they also suggested 4/8 for the provinces. Now, they didn't go out and shill for it. They didn't get out on the stump and go, we've got to have this, it's a great idea, because they didn't believe that anybody would go for it. But 8 years later, Proposition A came back. So this notion that somehow, oh, if we don't get this, don't worry, we'll put our sharpest minds on it and we'll get it hammered out next year and it'll all be fine, is nonsensical. We have literally been talking about how the qualifier system isn't really fit for purpose since it came into being 20 years ago. And there has been nothing since to suggest that we're going to get a better system. The Super 8s required every single scintilla of the then Director General's political power, persuasion and craft to get it through. And
which was a minor change.
And it lasted 2 years out of three. I think that, and it wasn't even, you weren't even allowed to make a change to that when everybody realised the system was broken by giving the Dubs two home games. It was like, oh, we're just going to have to live with this now. As opposed to saying, okay, we're baking in the possibility from the get-go that there will be changes made by the CCC if we need to, if we all agree that there's a problem with the new system. But no. Don't worry, we're going to be able to fix this. Next, we'll just have another Congress. We'll get everybody together and we'll use common sense. That's what we'll use. It's like the lads who came up with this one listened to every single shitty proposal on the back of a beer mat that they got sent into them, and these are the ones that end up getting distilled. And it's interesting that John Prenti's calling for more time to debate this. He's literally on the committee. He had the opportunity to make all these points to the committee in the rooms. And it's interesting that the provincial councils are now officially, publicly, all uniform against this. Turkey's voting for Christmas was what they told us on the show. Anyway, wasn't supposed to start the show with this. We were supposed to start the show with an amazing game last night in the Champions League where Liverpool announced themselves as the best team in Europe at the moment.
Oof. Yeah, they're certainly in the mix. It's what, themselves or Manchester City or Chelsea? Like, the best teams in the Premier League are the best teams in Europe right now. So I think as an attacking force, Liverpool are maybe as good as they've ever been right now. There's probably a few more questions about them defensively than there were a couple of years ago because Van Dijk isn't quite where he was, and particularly in Europe, Matip doesn't look to be the player he is in the Premier League. I think in the Premier League he plays on the front foot so much, but the goals they've conceded in Europe so far have almost all been replicas of each other. You think of the goals against AC Milan where they came on that sort of Matip Alexander-Arnold side. I think it was more Matip, and yeah, when he's defending on the edge of the area, it doesn't look particularly strong. But yeah, oh, these are yeah, European Super League, totally against it. But at the same time, when the superpowers do come together in the Champions League, they do always seem to bring out the very best in each other. And just the intensity in Atletico Madrid and Simeone acting like a complete lunatic on the sideline just adds to the magic of it all. And like the ferocity of the tackling, the pace of the game, the quality of the finishing. For a group stage game, it was probably as good as it gets.
A cowardly act from Diego Simeone is what Julian Lescott said last night with regards to him going off straight down the tunnel. A little bit harsh, I think.
Is that not Simeone? Yeah. Like Klopp did the whole, oh, I'm chasing him down half-heartedly for the handshake, so I look like the good guy out of all of this. Yeah, look, shake his hand. But Simeone obviously felt everything had gone against them with the red card and the penalty for Liverpool and the Atletico Madrid having the penalty overturned on VAR. But yeah, I think he just adds to the drama. You do wonder, does it must come out with the players and sort of the lack of discipline at times from Atletico Madrid in a game like that? But you watch Atletico Madrid and think that there's a team that's going to be in the quarterfinals almost certainly as well. And again, the team you do not want to play in the quarterfinals. Leaving Suarez out seemed like a strange decision, but then Griezmann turns up with a couple of goals. But like Salah again last night, every time, the quality of the first goal, they seem to have given him the first goal.
Really?
There seemed to be a constant split, but it seems as though they gave him the first goal somehow. James Milner clearly side-footed it in.
That's it's certainly down here as a Salah goal. That doesn't make any sense. If Griezmann got his goal, then Milner should have got the Salah goal. Granted, Griezmann is closer to goal, and it's kind of way more obvious, but maybe somebody just messed up. Maybe the computer says no or something like that. It was just a complete glitch in the system. Because that was a James Milner goal.
Well, maybe it was the best player in the world right now has scored a goal in our competition. Maybe we'll just give it to him. It's a better storyline than James Milner. It's a wonder goal for Mo Salah or a freak for James Milner. Which do you want?
Well, and I presume there's a bit of money involved for Mo Salah for every goal he scores. There's definitely, most of those strikers have score bonuses.
Yeah, so if he gets, 50 grand a goal, James Milner has no goal bonus. He says, I'll take the 50 grand, give you 20. We're all happy, James.
30.
You're giving them the vast majority.
Well, it's that or nothing. You're not making 50 here, Mo. You're making nothing. So what is it? 20 or 30?
I wonder if those negotiations ever happen.
Oh, yeah, of course they do, right? I mean, maybe not about goals like this, because, I mean, there's actually supposed to be an independent commission who sit and decide it, but... I mean, if I'm Milner, it's like, well, yeah, I get nothing, you get nothing, no big deal to me. You're going to give me the lion's share here, Mo. And besides, you got another 50 later on, no?
Yeah, possibly.
Does Naby Keita scoring a goal make up for the fact that Naby Keita got turned around and left acres of space behind him consistently throughout the evening last night, make up for things, Nathan?
Probably not. It doesn't feel as though Keita's ever going to be the main man in midfield, that if everybody is fit, he is number four, number five. Sort of like Matip, when you watch him in the Premier League and Liverpool have teams totally pushed back and teams that maybe aren't in the top four or five of the Premier League, Naby Keita is just fine then, because Liverpool don't have a huge amount of defending to do and everything happens in the opposition half. It's when you're playing one of the better teams that he does just seem to struggle. Like, he's busy, but doesn't seem to have the tactical know-how to put himself in the right position to sort of stop the counter-attacks well enough. He scored some nice goals for Liverpool and he looks a danger on the other end, but they do look a little bit more unbalanced when he's there, and they certainly look more unbalanced, and maybe it's unfair in Keita when Fabinho isn't there, because Henderson in that holding position last night as well seemed a little bit out of kilter, didn't seem to be able to provide as much cover as he normally would. So midfield of Milner, Henderson, Keita is a bit of a world away from the midfield of last season of a Fabinho, Wijnaldum and Henderson all at their absolute peak.
That's interesting. So their midfield is a world away from the quality it was last year, and yet they go to the home of the Spanish champions and get 3 points in the Champions League. Has this been underplayed a little bit, just the significance of this and what a marker this result is for Liverpool?
Quite possibly. When you look at what Atletico Madrid did to them a couple of years ago, and to go to the one Metropolitano and win and score three goals and start the way Liverpool started. Like, this is a pretty seismic victory. It almost guarantees their place in the knockout stage with three games to go. But like, Liverpool are a bloody good team. We know this at this stage, that when players are fit, when they're almost at full strength, with Salah playing the way he is, they're always going to score goals. They're always going to be a threat. So I think you expect that Liverpool will contend and be very, very close. Like, they are a team that if you're picking your top three contenders, Liverpool are there. They are one of the best teams in Europe. They were the best team in Europe a couple of seasons ago, so they know how to win these type of games now. So I wouldn't be massively shocked, but maybe it was the drama of the actual game is what everyone talks about, because so much happened, rather than the importance of it to Liverpool right now.
If we're to think about where Liverpool are now versus where they were last season, the speed at which they recovered and bounced back from, like, bear in mind, it was a bit of a fluke at the end that they actually got back into this competition, it felt like. And what's that down to? What was last year down to? Was it down to chronic mismanagement at the end of the previous season when they could have rested all their players and instead they didn't, and then everybody went off and got absolutely exhausted by playing in international competition and they just didn't understand what they were doing? What is it down to, apart from the Van Dijk injury? Because he isn't back, by his own admission, just yet to where he was.
Without rehashing a conversation of a year ago, Chair, I don't think you could just ignore the Van Dijk injury, and that was nothing to do.
I didn't say that
preseason or anything like that. That was a shocking challenge, but that, you know, you're talking about the best player in the league from the year before being gone for the entire season. But I don't
look. I know.
What's your point?
I guess my point is that he's not back to where he was, right? So I can't just pencil in that's the reason why they're suddenly back to Europe's best and England's best, when last season they were absolutely mediocre and he was playing in the Villa game.
He was, but geez, we are going back over the ground. Like, they conceded 7 goals against Aston Villa and went on, what, a 12-game unbeaten run after that. So they ended up playing Jordan Henderson and Fabinho at centre-halves. They took out their entire midfield. They had lost their entire defence. It's bound to have an impact on any team. If the same thing happened again this season, the same result would probably happen again this season for Liverpool. But there does seem to be, particularly from the front three, a shift in attitude. And maybe something happened over the course of the summer with Mane and Salah, and they were sat down. And I think I've even seen Mane celebrate a couple of goals at the start of this season.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's been noticeable that they have gone to each other and not like, not touching you. You're all sweaty. There's been none of that.
Exactly, and like, Salah's in the form of his life right now, so maybe that covers a few of those gaps at the back as Van Dijk does get himself back towards full fitness. I think Joel Matip has been outstanding in the Premier League for the first few weeks of the season. He seems to have added a totally different level to his game. He's the one who's sort of making up for Van Dijk, who's the one striding 20, 30 yards into the opposition half, and they're keeping teams pinned back. And that's Liverpool at their very best, is they don't let the opposition out of their own half, and that has to come from Salah, Mane, Jota, Firmino, pressure, 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 so that if you do get a clearance, you're under pressure clearing it, you're giving it straight back again. Alexander-Arnold probably got a bit of a kick up the backside last season. Again, looked somewhere close to his very best. And the midfield has always been industrious. So whether, and I think Fabinho's had a very good start to the season. So it's very similar to 2 years ago, 3 years ago, when they were competing and winning the league title and the Champions League title. It's the same formula. Not a huge amount has changed, I don't think, from 2-3 seasons ago. They've just managed to get back to that level. And like, for that, I guess you put it down to Jurgen Klopp and his brilliant management, his brilliant man management, and his ability to get these players working their ass off and consistently doing it every single game.
The relationship between the front three is interesting, because if you compare this team to 2 years ago, there was nobody coming off the bench as good as Diogo Jota. And I think it maybe makes it a little bit more comfortable politically for Jurgen Klopp if, like on Saturday, you have Salah, Mane and Firmino all on the score sheet. It doesn't give him any excuse to tinker with that front three whatsoever. And I guess Jota, maybe this is just a completely misplaced opinion here, Nathan, but it does seem that he will be the most accepting of a place in the bench throughout the season and accepting of that impact sub role, whereas Mane and Firmino, you get the sense, given they've been there longer and given they're Premier League champions, be a little bit more pissed off if Jota ever got ahead of them and managed to nail down that starting place for a prolonged period of time.
Yeah, I think Firmino's probably had to get his head around the fact that it's happening and it's going to happen. And again, of the front three, you'd probably say Firmino's the more likely to accept that than Salah or Mane. You know, when he's being substituted, he seems to stroll off the pitch. You don't get the sense he's ever going to throw his toys out of the pram. But that's what they need. Like, it can't be seen as a problem that Liverpool have some options actually in one or two areas of the pitch now, because we saw what happened last season with injuries. If Firmino, and even with the travel that these players are having to do for into the international game, I know Firmino wasn't involved, but if he gets him back fit, you'd expect to be back in the Brazil squad next time around, Roberto Firmino, that you need Jota. And you need Jota contributing. And he does look the most likely Jota to contribute off the bench all the time. Like, he's such a threat. The penalty he won last night, even though he did something stupid straight afterwards, but the penalty he won last night, like, they need that in every part of the pitch. And they probably do still lack a little bit in midfield. But maybe you look at it and think there's players missing. Fabinho wasn't there. Thiago wasn't there. Curtis Jones isn't there. And still they were able to put out a midfield of Milner, Henderson and Keita and win away at Atletico Madrid. Can you ask for much more than that from your midfield? It's not the huge depth and quality that some of the other sides have, but I just, every time I think of Liverpool and what makes this side great, like, it's Klopp. It is Jurgen Klopp. That is the secret sauce for this Liverpool side. He has something in his capabilities that gets these players working harder than any other team, even in Atletico Madrid, to be able to physically go up against that Atletico Madrid side, to have them on the back foot, to get Salah scoring the goals he's scoring, the quality of the goals he's scoring, like the finish for the Salah-Milner goal. Now, that comes from Salah 100 miles an hour scampering across the pitch to make sure he keeps it in play. He doesn't give up that ball. He wants that. He knows what's there away from home, that you have to make those hard yards even early in the game. And I think that comes back to the manager. So it feels like a conversation starting a bit more about Klopp and 2024, and will he stay on, or should Liverpool give him some sort of a sabbatical for a year and welcome him back? Because I think people realise that as much as Van Dijk might be the best in the world and Salah might be the best in the world, that if Klopp goes, like,
Cool. Yeah, but you can't sustain this level forever. Like, we've seen the burnout that Pep Guardiola has had in the past at Barcelona. When you've got the best situation in the world, the best team playing the best football, it was unsustainable for him. Now, they're obviously different people and they're different characters, but the level of investment emotionally and physically that Klopp makes, if you look back at, for example, the pictures of him when he arrived, he looks like a much younger man, despite all of the benefits he has.
Glasses.
You know, despite hair, all the benefits.
Laser eye surgery helped.
No, whatever. I was going to leave it unfilled in there, lads. You know, it's okay.
There could be other reasons.
Listeners know exactly what we're talking about. It's a beautiful man. And obviously,
it does. You're right. And enjoy this. Enjoy it while it's... enjoy it if you're a Liverpool fan while it's happening, because it won't last forever and Klopp won't be around forever. But as a club, do you allow him to leave for a season on the assumption he comes back and he's as good as ever? Give it to his assistant?
Give it to Giggsy? I don't know. Maybe then you're always searching for that bit, these drugs, this high, and it never really comes back. I don't know. Maybe things have to change. Maybe you realise that if you're the owners, that he's made you billions over the course of his time there, the value of the club has increased so much and the profits that they're making every year, he's probably worth that amount. So you probably do bend the rules for somebody like him and think of him maybe, and you know, it's a Steve Jobs situation where he leaves for a while and comes back and the second flush and the third flush are even better than the first flush. I don't know. Maybe that's what they have to do.
It does seem as though, and listen, he's always been very forthright, and I think we've spoken before about his intensity around match day, that people see a sort of lovely, cuddly Klopp at times, and he's the manager everyone would want to go for a pint with, but like post-match interviews, he has no time for anybody. It is 100% gets his message out and get out of there. And watching his press conference on last Friday ahead of the Newcastle game, it was... First, he was a masterclass in just being open and honest and being a voice for football in the way he spoke about Newcastle and Saudi Arabia. It was so unusual to hear a manager sit and be that critical of the Premier League and of Richard Masters and what Saudi Arabia are trying to do with Newcastle. And this went on for 20 minutes where he went bang, 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 bang. Every question he was asked, he basically took somebody out of it. Again, spoke about Newcastle and Saudi Arabia is going to buy every team in the Premier League. Is that how they're going to sort this out? That maybe it'll be fair in 10 years' time because Saudi Arabia own everyone and we all have the same amount of money. He went to town on Gareth Southgate about not picking Joe Gomez in the squad. He went to town on Lee Carsley about playing Curtis Jones in an under-21 game. Went to town on Watford for always sacking their managers, even though they're playing Watford the day after. It feels a bit like the shackles are off of him at the moment. He can sort of say what he wants when he wants, that he has a full understanding of his power and the weight of his words, and he's not afraid to use them. And maybe that's just the period he's in his career, or maybe it's this is all going to be coming to an end soon. I'll do what the hell I want.
It's hard to know, isn't it? And that's why we definitely should enjoy it while it lasts, because Liverpool fans, particularly of your age, have an understanding of the cyclical nature of this, that this isn't what it's going to be like forever, that there's an at-bat at the moment, and they need to capitalise by winning as many trophies as they possibly can. And last year's down year seems to have helped to revitalise the squad for this year. There's a few caveats, obviously, the injury profile of some of those players and the strength and depth. And here we are, it's very early in the season. And if there are injuries to a few key players, then all of a sudden this disappears. And that's not quite the same at Chelsea. That's not quite the same at Manchester City. We see Ferran Torres out and they can actually absorb that for now. It's fine. We'll see as the season goes on. But as it stands right now, this must be as good as it gets to be a Liverpool fan.
Well, I think when they won the league and pretty much won their first 20 games was
Liverpool supporters. This is not a today thing. I think you're leaning back into the last few years.
The Liverpool supporters who can probably remember the mid-80s might question it, but I think for the style of football that they play as well, as much as anything, that's, you go to Anfield, you're going to be entertained right now. You're going to see goals. You're going to see some of the best talents in the world. And you're going to see a good attitude. A team are going to get after it. I think that's what Jurgen Klopp has created. Again, from the second Champions League season, from the season they won it, you didn't look at Liverpool and think this was a sort of freak. You thought, actually, this is one of, if not genuinely the best team in Europe who can compete with Chelsea, Manchester City, Paris Saint-Germain and Bayern Munich. And that's probably the short list right now, isn't it?
We've kind of touched on it briefly, but are you concerned about Van Dijk at all?
Not massively. He's not making massive glaring errors at the moment. But it just feels as though he doesn't look as comfortable himself. He's not getting on the ball quite as much. He doesn't seem to be pinging those crossfield passes quite as comfortably as he did. But they do seem to be able to manage him. They left him out of a game recently enough. You'd imagine they won't overly push it. But he is back playing with the Dutch team as well. He was in last month with them. So he hasn't had a niggly injury yet, which is quite often what happens after a serious knee injury like that, where you know, you have suddenly the hamstring goes, it has a calf injury, and you're out for another 3 or 4 weeks. I think Van Dijk will be fine. Maybe he never gets back to that level. Maybe he never gets back to being the best centre-back in the world right now, and he doesn't cover the errors that Matip makes or Gomez makes. But I think Liverpool are still a far better side, and just the presence he has makes them a far better side.
Okay, I want to tell everybody what's coming up between now and 10 o'clock because we have a very busy programme for you with some superstar guests and Nathan. We're going to continue talking about the Champions League reaction. We're going to preview Ireland's big game tomorrow night, which you can hear live here on Off the Ball from Tala, 7 o'clock kickoff against the Swedes. GAA Congress going to talk about that from 8:05. We're going to fill in the map of how we think the 32 counties are voting, but we're also going to give you some details on how actually the 32 counties aren't that important when it comes to this decision, that our brethren from abroad will have about 20% of the vote. Central Council will have another significant chunk, and then the counties themselves who will end up playing in this championship will get their diluted say. The sports pages at 8:30, which are largely Liverpool and Congress. We've got Mark Lawrenson to join us at 8:50 to give us his thoughts. Peter Stringer is going to join us at 9:05 in studio to talk to us about the depth chart at scrum half at the moment and also his new fitness business. And then we'll play out with Mick Foley talking more about Congress at 7:57 this morning. We'd love to hear from you. 0879 180 180 is the WhatsApp number if you want to get in touch. And of course, OTBAM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. So tomorrow night you're live in Tala for Ireland against Sweden. The game is all live with thanks to Sky, proud primary partner and supporter of the Republic of Ireland women's national football team. We're going to hear from Vera Powell in a moment, Nathan, but what your expectation for this is, like, a routine defeat? I think maybe you should put some context on just how good this Swedish team are.
Well, they're the second ranked team in the world right now. They recently got to the Olympic final. They were only beaten on penalties by Canada. All their players are playing for the top clubs in the world. They're one of the traditional superpowers of the women's game. When most of the world was fully focused on the men's game and has spent the last 20 years playing catch up, you know, Sweden were on top of this very, very early. They, you know, always get to the World Cup. They always get to the European Championship. They always go deep in the competition. They finished third at the last World Cup. They finished runners-up within the last 20 years as well. So like, this is as tough a task as you could have to start your qualifying campaign as well. So yeah, on paper, you say a routine defeat. But I think you always look for the same things from an Irish side when you're going up against one of the best teams in the world. Can you unsettle them? Can you make life uncomfortable? Can you ask a couple of questions and nick a goal and maybe get the crowd behind you? Unfortunately, it looks as though it's still going to be only half a stadium at Tala because it's just coming a few hours or the regulations end. But Ireland went up against one of the better teams in the world last month in Australia and beat them. So hopefully the confidence they've taken from that can help them kick on. It would be the shock of the qualifying stage if Ireland were to win this. Like, that is what they're up against here. But it's felt there's been progress. The results haven't shown progress, and the defeat to Ukraine just seemed to knock the stuffing out of these players. Maybe more than it should have. It seems to have had such a hangover from that going on a year, 18 months, that you just hope that those demons were banished by the victory over Australia and they can go and give a really good outing, because they've a huge game then next week as well against Finland. And the likely scenario is that regardless of what happens tomorrow night, Sweden will win this group. Only one team qualifies automatically. The second place team goes into a playoff, and it's not even a one-legged playoff. You've got two games and then you go into another round of a playoff. So it's a huge task again to qualify for World Cup. But finishing second, getting to a playoff is where Ireland feel they need to be. That will be progress. And it'll be between the Republic of Ireland and Finland, you feel, for that. Sweden have already played a couple of games. They've won both of them. The last one, they won 4-0 against Georgia, but they had 45 shots in that game. So obviously the Georgian goalkeeper had the game of their life. Before that, they won 1-0 away at Sweden. So maybe
Finland.
Not fully
Slovakia.
Firing.
Slovakia.
Or Slovakia, sorry. Sweden won 1-0 away at Slovakia. So maybe not fully firing at all in those first couple of games. But like this, it's a shame it won't be a full house. Like this is as tough as it gets.
It's also kind of like the first kind of step into a new campaign where it feels that they can get close to a sellout in Tala. Like it does feel like the last campaign was just on a massive upward trajectory in terms of the national interest in this team, if not necessarily the results. But even that kind of did play into some of the performances that we saw. Like you mentioned Australia is the most recent one, but even competing against better teams like Iceland and Belgium, and even between the two Germany games in the last campaign, it seemed that there was a step up. Granted, that last game against Germany was like a do or die match, so there was probably a little bit more on the line that day than there was for Germany. But it did seem that they had started to figure out these games in terms of how to live with a top to your nation.
Yeah, and Vera Pau seems to have added a lot in terms of the organization of the side, in terms of making them difficult to beat, in terms of maybe a bit more streetwise in these sort of games. And also a lot of the younger players are starting to play at a better level. And I think having that support behind them is obviously a huge thing. That the FAI were proactive in, I think a couple of years ago, giving out a lot of free tickets, getting people to Tala, showing them the experience, showing them how up close you can get with the players and with the pitch. And that generates interest, but also I think there's just a natural interest now in the women's game because it's on our TV screens all the time. We're seeing Katie McCabe's goal. It's all over social media every week, every time she scores a cracker. So people are starting to understand the level that the players are playing at, that the quality is improving all the time, and that these are games that are worth going to, that are entertaining matches, and that mean something, that really do mean something. And a game like this is a huge, huge game for Irish sport and for Irish football. So I think people should go, and they realise and now have expectations. That's the other thing I think that's changed, is that, you know, if Ireland do go and get a beating tomorrow night, the criticism will be harsh. It won't be, didn't they do well? Didn't they try their best against Sweden? Like, people will be looking at Vera Pau, they'll be looking at that long run of defeats before the victory against Australia, and a lot of questions will be asked. And likewise, if it doesn't go well against Finland next week, like that's what's there now for this women's team. That's where they want to be. I think that's exactly where they want to be. So, yeah, it's going to be a huge, huge game. And you do hope they can stick in it in the first half an hour. Maybe the Swedes get a little bit frustrated. Maybe Katie McCabe turns up, gets herself a goal. And it's one of those really memorable, memorable nights for Irish football. But as I say, it's as tough a task as they could have.
Okay, we're going to hear from Vera Pau after these.
OTB AM.
The situation at the moment for national teams at our level, where we haven't played finals yet, is that we miss six games a year because slots have been taken out by FIFA for Champions League games. But our players, only a few of our players are in those Champions League, Katie McCabe, for example. So that means that we have to congest everything in those few days. And therefore, we also work with the players, especially the players who do not play that much, out of camp, with video clips, with phone calls, with Teams meetings. And where necessary, only when necessary. And that helps us growing, not only the players that play, but also the players that are either on the fringe or on the bench, because everybody is growing at the moment.
You mentioned that they're growing and the team is making progress, but do you think if you had those 6 weeks extra, the progress would be quicker?
Of course, it's six games. Mm. And six games in a year under that pressure is a lot. I've been discussing with UEFA if there's a solution for it. I have said that it might be a solution to open up a few of the Champions League slots for friendlies, international friendlies, and without the Champions League players, of course, because it's a Champions League week. And let's see if that suggestion gets some ground, because if you want to avoid that the gap gets bigger between the top nations and the second tier, is that the right word? We're just knocking on the door of the top nations. If you don't take care of that, then that gap will grow instead of that it gets smaller.
We've got a roadshow before it as well, Nathan, so coverage will actually start on our social channels a good bit earlier, and kickoff is at 7, is that right?
Yeah, kickoff at 7. We're on our social channels from 5:30. We've got Emma Byrne, Ruth Fahey and James O'Callaghan, who's the Piemont United manager, going to be with Adrian for the pre-game show from 5:30 on all our social channels. And then myself and Emma Byrne will be on commentary from 7.
All right. Hagen Burkhardt, hello to you, Hagen, or Guten Tag, says, hello from Germany. There's no one better than Lewandowski right now, and Klopp would never stop for 1 year and start again. Regards from Germany.
I think Bayern have to be factored into that conversation as well at the top, Nathan, when you're like, who's the best team in the world? I think it's the Premier League teams plus Bayern, really, if you're looking to judge it.
And you'll have to assume Paris Saint-Germain will get it together by the end of the season and be a factor in all this. But what is Lewandowski? 9 goals in 8 games so far this season in the Bundesliga. So he's on a par with Salah, I think it's fair to say. Yeah, but Bayern are definitely going to be a threat in the knockout stages, but the knockout stage of the Champions League are always as good as it gets in terms of football and quality.
Yeah,
and
a few underappreciated for now storylines from last night was the absolute mullering that Borussia Dortmund took at the hands of Ajax. So you kind of felt like maybe there was a possibility of Ajax keeping the team together, of Dortmund keeping the team together for a while if they actually were potentially European champions. That's not going to happen. They're not going to be able to recover from that. Their defence is chaotic. So that means that there will be a domino falling in the summertime in Haaland. I do wonder if Lewandowski might actually be on the market next summer, because there was enough noise around him to suggest that perhaps he wants to try something new and cash in one last time and get a longer deal from somebody than he's going to get from Munich. And Munich might be interested in Haaland. I'm sure they are.
Well, there was speculation at the weekend, all right, that Bayern were trying to figure out exactly what would happen with Haaland before making a decision in Lewandowski's future, that if Haaland was to come, Lewandowski would leave because they would be able to keep the two of them in the same team. And the traditional route in Germany has always been from Borussia Dortmund to Bayern Munich, whereas the obsession has been with Haaland going to a Real Madrid or a Manchester City or a Manchester United. Like, you would have to factor in Bayern Munich, that if they again go in, the links that they would have with Borussia Dortmund, that if they want them, they've got a very good chance of getting them.
One of the other threads from that game last night is Erik ten Hag and Manchester United fans on social media going crazy over ten Hag, saying he needs to be the guy to replace Ole. And you would wonder if there is going to be a scenario where that does develop over the next little while and ten Hag isn't Frank de Boer 2.0 and actually makes a success maybe of a big job in the Premier League. How regretful Tottenham Hotspur would be, because the stories from the summer was that ten Hag made a very weak impression with Daniel Levy. His English wasn't great. Only wanted to bring in one of his coaches rather than overhauling the entire coaching ticket, and eventually then signed a new contract with Ajax and has been amazing. And Ajax have been sensational in the Champions League so far this season, with that win last night clearly the high point so far. So you'd wonder if he actually over the next couple of months edges his way to the front of that queue, like the conversation that people are having, like Antonio Conte is probably the number one candidate when all these managerial roles come up. And I know Ten Hag is not out of a job, but his name had been previously mentioned in the past. I wonder just how high his stock is going to rise over the next little while.
This is an end of season thing, I presume. Does anyone believe Ole is going to be gone before the end of the season?
I think there's a possibility. I think if they were to crash out of the Champions League in the next two games and get spanked at the weekend. Now, pardon me. I don't, you know, more than likely they will stick. That's been the hallmark of the owner since they've arrived. They've given everybody much longer to the end of the season. I do think that there's a chance that they'll clear house, and if somebody good was available to take over, which would help them, because there's no guarantee they're going to finish fourth at the moment. That's the level of form they're at.
Yeah, I still think they'll have enough attacking talent to finish inside the top four. Is Erik ten Hag a big enough name after an Ole Gunnar Solskjaer for Manchester United, or will the Glazers be thinking, we want somebody to appease the supporters, we just want the biggest name possible? Maybe at the time that is Antonio Conte. You probably have Conte ahead of ten Hag in terms of the likely managers that they're going after. Are they going to go after a young coach who's going to transform the club at Manchester United? Doesn't feel like it. Everything feels they just want to finish inside the top four.
Well, I do wonder how much damage De Boer has done to that brand of bringing in an Ajax manager, and then I wonder how much damage Donny van de Beek has done to the brand of Ajax as well in the corridors of Old Trafford.
Well, it was Daley Blind scoring last night as well. It was a cracker of a goal he scored. Ten Hag's 51, so he's not young. He's not a youngster. He's got no hair. That helps make it look like you're older.
It is amazing how the Eredivisie and maybe just Ajax even in Europe is just this breeding ground for Premier League failures. They're maybe calling Blind a Premier League failure is too strong, but Sebastian Haller was on the scoreline as well last night. It's just if you have underwhelmed in the Premier League, go to the Netherlands and you will succeed even on the Champions League level.
Well, their record.
I know you can say Sebastian Haller. Sorry, I was going to say Sebastian Haller did underwhelm in the Premier League at West Ham, but was his last touch pretty much in the Premier League not more or less the goal of the season last season, that overhead kick.
Forgot about that.
And then bizarrely, they sold him about 24 hours later.
So they beat Dortmund 4-0 last night. They beat Beşiktaş 2-0 at home. And they won 5-1 in Lisbon against Sporting.
Mm-hmm. It's the top of the hipster group.
Well, it's like 9 points, goal difference plus 10, three Champions League games in. Mm-hmm. They've basically already qualified.
Yeah, yeah. And I think they've only lost one game in the domestic league so far, the top of the table there.
Yeah, you would be suspicious though. Who knows? Maybe he's the new Tuchel. Maybe he's the new Klopp, and you're getting him at that stage of the cycle where it's going to be a feverish brilliance that you're injecting into the club. Mm, but is Ronaldo going to look at him and go, "Yeah, I want this"?
That's the thing. It does seem very kind of transfer markety, like looking at that and saying we can copy and paste all the qualities that he's brought to that club and bring it into the club here. But then the flip side of that is maybe there's just a complete level of snobbery about that. And, you know, sort of there's an element of Jim White turning his face up at the idea of Lucien Favre coming into Newcastle United as if he'd never heard of him and hadn't heard of the work he'd done. Like, there is that level of snobbery that does exist around the Premier League and managers out foreign who probably wouldn't be able to do it. Like, if Conte hadn't done his...
Get curbs in to the end of the season.
The reason why Conte is so highly valued is because of what he did with Chelsea. And like, he should be valued because of all the other things he did as well, like at domestic level and with the national team in Italy. But it's certainly the Chelsea thing that I would say makes him the most attractive prospect if you were to talk to Manchester United fans.
Conte right now at Manchester United would be fascinating because he's so sure of himself and how he wants to play and how he'll want to set up a team that he won't give a damn about dropping whatever players he wants to fit into his system. So suddenly players who are out of the mix will probably be back in. And you'd imagine Conte be looking at that front five or six and thinking, well, I maybe do without three. And how would that sit in the dressing room?
I don't know. I mean, I think...
And is that what the Glazers want? Like, do the Glazers want two or three of their superstars sitting on the bench for success?
No, they want them. They want them sold, and they want to balance the books, and they want the club to make sense. And what happened was that Solskjaer came in and made a bit of sense early on. He got rid of some very expensive assets, which were completely depreciating, and drew a line, and things got to the point where the club was unified and the fans stopped giving out about stuff, and then that all changed with the Super League, and it's like, oh, okay, we need to revisit this again. So maybe Solskjaer is going to be one of the big losers in the Super League thing because it kind of reanimated the base of supporters and took away that whole sense that we're one club, we're united again, it's the Solskjaer way, it's the Ferguson way, it's all part of that long arc. It's very interesting to see what's going to happen and who the candidates are, and that means these games in the Champions League are referendums on Solskjaer at the moment.
Yeah, and there's been a sense that maybe that Old Trafford match going public are slightly changing their tune over the last few weeks. I suppose the goals have dried up a little bit. The frustration levels are starting to rise, and how can it not be a big week when you've got Atlanta, Liverpool, Atlanta again, Spurs, Manchester City, if it all goes horribly wrong, but that's has a habit of dragging a result out of somewhere at the right time. Would you be shocked if Ronaldo popped up at a last minute winner against Liverpool on Sunday?
Not at all.
I would, yeah.
That would be
hashtag narrative.
No, I
against
think...
this Liverpool team right now playing the way they are. Surely never give a sucker an even break is tattooed inside the eyelids. The laser bounced back off the eyeballs and in the eyelids is don't give these suckers an even break. Klopp is into his team going, you've got an extra 24 hours rest. Look at them tonight. We're going to kill.
Well, I'll see that and I'll raise you Anthony Martial essentially winning the Ballon d'Or with his one performance against Manchester City earlier in the year when Manchester United were sleepwalking towards the end of the year and Martial just was unbelievable. And that I'm almost convinced that something like that is going to happen over the course
City
of the
City had
games.
That flakiness in them in this.
Guardiola might be a City game in, rather than Liverpool.
Guardiola gets in his own head a bit around that, and you can see how that happens. But Klopp's not going to get in his own head, is he? He's going to pick the same team as he picked last night. Oh, maybe. Well, sorry.
He'll bring Fabinho back in.
You can feck
he'll
off,
bring Fabinho
Naby.
Back into the side.
We love your hustle.
And
that's
Curtis
why
Jones might be back fit.
Right.
So I'd say if Jones and Fabinho are fit, they'll start. And maybe because Jota didn't play for the first hour last night, maybe Jota comes in to start as well. And maybe the dynamic of this game has changed, even though there was a terrible 0-0 last season. That there have also been a couple of dominant Liverpool performances over the last couple of seasons. Like last season at Old Trafford, they absolutely battered United after the first sort of half an hour of the game. So maybe they figured Manchester United out finally last season.
Okay, so give me your prediction about what's going to happen.
Tonight or on Sunday or with Manchester
for
United?
For Manchester United over these next 3 weeks. They're going to win tonight, draw against Liverpool, and Solskjaer's got to the end of the season.
No, I think Liverpool will win on Sunday. I think they probably win tonight, and I don't see him going either way. I'd say he'll get enough out of Spurs and Manchester City to just about survive.
All right. Nathan, good stuff. Thanks a million for joining us. Just one last
thing.
Do you think Mayo are actually going to vote no?
I don't know. The developments of the last 24 hours where it turns out there might be amendments made on the day, and also the fact that counties are given free votes seem to have added another layer of complication to all this. And certainly if nothing happens, I think the fact that free votes have been given to delegates will really rile up the players. That like all we've ever heard is get on the committee, represent, and you get your vote. And now we've been told that maybe the delegates won't reflect actually what the membership wants, that they'll just go off what they want to do themselves, which seems bizarre. I've no idea what Mayo are going to do, but James Horan isn't totally in favour of Proposal B, but clearly the players are in favour of Proposal B, so I think they should vote for Proposal B.
17 minutes past 8, Nathan Murphy, good. Thanks very much. This is OTBAM, brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with our new and improved razors. We'll talk more Champions League with Lauro a little bit later on. And if you're a Man United fan, just what is your level of anxiety ahead of this run of games? Are you a Manchester United fan who wants rid of Solskjaer at this point? Are these the championship minutes where actually it's make or break? And if he breaks, then fair enough, you get somebody new. And who do you want? What's better?
I think maybe they would prefer either to win all these games or to lose all these games. Maybe just be the if there is a sort of
purgatory in between.
Yeah, like in fairness, I do think that there will be they'll come out of these games with probably maybe a couple of wins. I think they've got a chance. I think they'll beat Atalanta.
They should.
One of the games, and perhaps draw the other one. The City, I think they might beat Tottenham, and then City and Liverpool. Like again, as we said earlier on, it wouldn't be a surprise to see them take one of those games. But
they should beat Spurs. For all the talk about Spurs being great again, Spurs aren't great.
Well, they could definitely cause that United defence problems. Like, I mean, we're going to have to see what the fitness situation is like. But I mean, when you've got Son and Kane coming back to their best potentially, and Ndombele looking like an attacking midfielder that Spurs wanted to sign a couple of years ago, then there's enough there to cause Manchester United a lot of problems. So it is a really, really difficult run, but Solskjaer's had a habit of pulling out big results when he really needs to. So I think we'll still be in a little bit of limbo after these five games.
Okay, it's 19 minutes past 8. Here's the newspapers. We'll start with otbsports.com. Newcastle criticism is mounting as clubs block sponsorship deals. Rob Harris speaking on the football show last night. Meath, Clare and Tip had their backing to Proposal B. How a young cricket star in India reimagined himself in Malahide. No Rovers fans at Daily Mail next month, with Bowes disappointed over ticket allocation. And sometimes I feel guilty talking about some of the things going on in my head. That's Keith Earls speaking at the launch of his new book. The Telegraph has Mo Salah on the back page. Super Salah's double delight. The Guardian has Mo Salah. And you can see the progress. Solskjaer backs himself to turn United around. So that's the backing of the board and the backing of Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. For Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, it's a good time to be Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. You're getting a lot of backing. Mo KO for Atletico. Or is it Mo Co for Atletico? You can't really say KO is Co, can you?
No, you really
can't. But sometimes for the headline to scan properly, you need to say stuff that's not real.
You certainly do. Either way, it rhymes, and that's all that matters.
Ireland boost as full houses return to Aviva, but not in time for the women's football team, as we heard earlier. UK cycling secret drug test scheme. We get into the story in the coming days, but it looks like British Cycling were conducting illicit private drug tests on their riders ahead of the 2012 London Olympic Games, which obviously was a spectacular success for the British Cycling team. One of the all-time great moments by any team in any sport. The level of dominance that they achieved was off the charts. But it turns out that they were doing illicit private drug tests on their own riders with the knowledge of the UK anti-doping a year out from the Olympic Games. You're not supposed to test your own riders. The only people who are supposed to test are the anti-doping agency, who are supposed to come kind of unannounced and swoop in and go, oh, ah, gotcha. Or, oh, no, you're clean. Well done. Didn't get you this time. But what they were doing in England was like testing all the time. Why would you test your own? Why would you test your own people? What's the benefit of testing your own people? In a statement issued last night, this is Matt Lawton's story. I haven't seen it anywhere else, so if it's not an exclusive, then fair. But Matt Lawton's an unbelievable work on British cycling and the Jiffy bag and all that stuff. So you'll remember him from such escapades as the Jiffy bag and the stolen laptops and all that kind of stuff. Really brilliant work, like a career case in many aspects. In a statement issued last night, the World Anti-Doping Agency said their Operation Echo had confirmed potential wrongdoing by individuals in both British cycling and UK anti-doping. So they're saying that the sport and the anti-doping agency charged with keeping an eye on the sport have done wrong. We've never seen anything like this before, have we? Where the people whose job it was to keep an eye on what was happening were involved with the people. Oh, wait, we have seen that before. Wasn't that the whole point of Icarus? Isn't this what happened in Russia? It's very similar to what happened in Russia.
But of course, I mean, with the Sochi Games, only the Russians could get carried away with that sort of level of potential patriotism that comes from a massive sporting event like that. This is a huge, huge story. This is the biggest story in quite some time. And there have been a hell of a lot of stuff that's come out about the London 2012 Games, because that medal factory, which it has been referred to in a non-ironic way down through the years, is the shining light, supposedly, of British sport. And it wasn't just about the London 2012 Games. The culture that they had supposedly generated in that medal factory was something that filtered into the Tour de France, into a whole pile of other Grand Tours.
Into pop culture.
This is the starting point and the pride of British sport. And there are massively damaging allegations being made now, which is on a layer of other massively damaging allegations that we've seen over the past, I want to say, 4 or 5 years, ever since Lawton got that tip on the Jiffy bag. It really has just been a constant chiselling away at the integrity of what we've seen from UK cycling.
So the same damning water report said that in 2018, the UK anti-doping agency, UCAD, failed to act properly when provided with anonymous claims that a coach of British Cycling was attempting to dope athletes, and that there was a clear trail of emails about the screening programme between British Cycling and UK anti-doping. The Times understands that in 2011, a sample provided by a member of the all-conquering British track cycling team contained minute traces of nandrolone, a banned substance. So, if you can put that all together, they're testing, and they find something. We never heard about it. What are we, 10 years on from 2011? We didn't hear about it. But we all watched the Olympic Games in 2012 in London, when medal after medal after medal and record after record after record and marginal gains were all the, oh, this is going to be the future for the world. We're taking over. So going to be very interesting to see what happens with this. It's the back page of the London Times this morning, and it's a huge story. If you get the time, you should have a look at it. Farrell set to name veteran trio for Autumn Series. So Sexton, Keith Earls and Cian Healy back in the Ireland squad. It'll be named today. We'll get Brian O'Driscoll's thoughts on that. It'll be app exclusive tonight. You can get it on the OTB Sports app. Download the OTB Sports app now. Mighty Mo is the front of the Examiner. They also have Aidan O'Mahony talking about his new book. We'll get him in studio over the next week or so. Cork. Very progressive board in Cork. Very progressive young CEO. The future of the GAA rests in the hands of people like the new CEO in Cork. It's like it's one of the few things that really gives you comfort about what is coming down the tracks. Championship revamp gets Cork boost. So Cork have come out in favour of proposal B, that advocates for the league as championship as the centrepiece in the summer intercounty season. So former chair Tracy Kennedy spoke in favour of it, current PRO Joseph Blake spoke in front of it, and Kevin O'Donovan, who was on the Saturday panel with John Duggan last Saturday. You should listen back to it because you can just get an indication of that guy's clever and has come right through the system from a games promotion officer right to be in charge. And it was a great interview he gave recently with, I think, Kieran Shannon, talking about the boxes that people need to be in and how the boxes all need to talk to each other. But other counties should be scared of what's happening in Cork because they've got their house in order.
Yeah, there's a red wave coming steadily, certainly in, well, hopefully just in hurling over the next little while, and that's certainly how they've got their house in order, as a result of how they got their house in order. But I think that's really interesting that someone like Kevin O'Donovan has come through as a result of maybe Cork not doing everything very well over the last little while. I mean, they have learned from mistakes and they have learned from a different way of doing things to move into the modern age, Cork GAA. Like, what's going to be really interesting is, as a result of Saturday, how much does the GAA also learn from this experience? And maybe that won't happen immediately, because maybe there is this naive thought that if a progressive move doesn't happen on Saturday, that the progressive move will happen next year. I think you and I are both agree that we're not convinced on that whatsoever. But can the GAA finally turn that attitude a little bit? And I'm not sure that that's the case, because we have to remember the political power that the provincials hold, not just the competition power.
Cloud nine. So figure nine, spelled out nine. They're the headlines on both the back of the Sun and the Mirror this morning. Unstoppable Salah makes Reds history, says the Sun. And record breaker Salah scores double as VAR rescues win in Madrid thriller. So he's first Liverpool player to score in nine consecutive games. Now, 9:27 this morning here on OTBAM, brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. Will O'Callaghan is with us. Will has been appointed as our amateur cephalologist, our resident John King. We're crunching the numbers, Will.
We are, and there's still a lot of ground, lads, that still has to be decided over the next while, particularly that meeting of the Ulster counties last evening in Armagh, where it's believed that the secretary and chairpersons, who are going to be likely delegates for this Saturday for the counties involved, met with the Ulster Council to discuss a range of issues, but among them were the motions coming up this Saturday, including Proposal B. And then it emerged overnight that it looks like Down are now going to turn green, which is perhaps a little bit of a surprise. The kind of A lot of county board meetings were taking place last evening, so we've been able to chart a map so far about where counties are intending to vote ahead of Saturday. Now, before we start with the Greens, you look at the Blues that are on the map, which we have drawn up, and they're the counties who are going to have a free vote going into Saturday, which I think is significant, because in those counties, the reasoning given, at least by Kerry and by Laois, Waterford, it was their delegates who decided to leave an option of a free vote available for their delegates for this weekend, is that they're waiting to see what actually hits the Congress floor. And if reports are to be believed, Proposal A may well be pulled even before it hits the clore for this weekend. And there is the potential, at least according to the Laois chairman, Peter O'Neill, who spoke yesterday about Laois's position, that there may well be amendments to Proposal B before it even gets voted on at lunchtime on Saturday. So the counties who've given a free vote so far, you're looking at Laois, Waterford. Waterford had their meeting last night, and they were empowered, their delegates, by the clubs to have a free vote for this weekend, so they can decide on whatever is put forward on Saturday lunchtime. You've got Limerick, who are also giving a free vote as things stand, and Kerry. And then the significant counties that went green overnight, Cork, who you mentioned, Clare had their county board meeting and they officially rubber-stamped the thinking of their management committee. Tipperary's five votes, which is significant with the amount of delegates that they have, they've gone green. Wexford this morning announcing that last night they made the decision that they're going to be supporting Proposal B. You've then got a raft of Midlands counties, really Longford, Westmeath and Offaly. We already knew about the Westmeath and Offaly positions from last week. Both Meath and Kildare opting for Proposal B. Louth, who had already declared their support for it. Down, which is the significant one that we perhaps weren't expecting to be pro-Proposal B. And then you've got Sligo, who also are intending to vote for Proposal B. It leaves a lot of counties still undecided. And I think there's a lot of suspicion, at least when it comes to some of the Connacht counties and Ulster counties, that they will turn red and there'll be no votes for this weekend. But with 3 days to go, it looks pretty wide open at the moment.
The open vote and leaving it up to Saturday, the reason behind that, Will, I presume, is either there is still an acceptance that they might vote for Proposal A, or that's one reason for this. The second one is that their vote is dependent on the tweaks that come to Proposal B. So is there any other reason why they would leave an open vote, do you think? Because to me, that's the only reason why you could make that argument.
I think it's more likely to be the latter reason, in that they're waiting to see what the amendments are going to be ahead of this weekend. Because I spoke to a couple of Laois players on the back of Laois's declaration from Monday night's meeting that they would be giving their delegates a free vote, but that they were tending towards voting yes. And the Laois players had handed a pretty strong mandate to the county board, and the county board had said they're going to listen to their players, but they want to see exactly what they'd be voting on. It seems from the reports coming out of the Waterford meeting last night, it's also a similar position, where they're trending towards voting yes, but they want to see what's actually there before they vote, and their delegates will be allowed to make a decision on the day. Kerry, a bit more of a poker face position, based on the comments that came out of their county board meeting, where they're genuinely, their delegates are going to wait and they're going to vote based on what's put before them. Similarly, we get the feeling that Limerick are tending towards voting in favour of Proposal B, but again, they're going to be allowed to free vote on it. And the caveat that comes with all this, and every single delegate that goes to Congress this weekend, is that the CPA attempted a few years ago to get transparency around where votes actually go when the vote takes place. But we have no idea if, when the buttons are pressed, who has voted where. Like, people may well be mandated to go and vote, but a delegate, even who has been whipped by their county to vote in a certain way, may not actually vote in the way that they're told to do so.
They should bring that motion to Congress every year and see does it ever get below 86% of rejection.
It seems unlikely that that vote would take place. It was so strongly rejected at the time back in, I think it was 2018 Congress when that happened. So Congress is a weird thing, guys. Having been there a few times as a delegate, the lobbying takes place even between sessions. When you go out for lunch, counties will meet
and talk about how
they're going to vote.
Back up the truck. Having been there as a delegate.
Yeah, only ever as an underage delegate, but I did two congresses and a special congress as an Offaly delegate.
Hang on a second. Well, you've kept this completely buried forever. What? So what does an underage delegate mean?
Someone that's not 60.
Yeah, exactly. You go along and look, back then, at least for a full congress, you always had an underage delegate. I believe there's a slight change in the amount of delegates that are attending for this special congress. I think some counties are going to have 5 and some are going to have 3. It was an interesting experience, guys.
Offaly have 3. Michael Dagnan told us last week Offaly will have 3 this time. When you were there, how many did they have?
We had 5, I think. There was 4 from the county board executive, and then I was the underage delegate on as well. You had full voting rights while you were there.
Well, that's what I ask. Yeah, okay. So you were pressing your little button.
There you go. I think
that came out wrong.
The first year I was there, was Rule 42, which in the end got pushed back to the year afterwards. And then we had a special Congress, which had changes around the playing rules. And then we had 42 being adopted the next year on the second year when I was an underage delegate. So it's intriguing. I mean, maybe with COVID, things are slightly different. And with a special Congress, everyone just kind of arrives into Dublin on the day. And it's different to the Congress itself, where it's like a 3-day event where people go down on the Friday. But genuinely, there are conversations taking place between chairpersons in the hallways over a pint, deciding on how they're going to vote, any amendments that may take place beforehand. People discuss who's going to go up and speak, who's going to propose changes that may be made to motions on the day as well. It's GA politics. You were saying earlier, you're trying to make kind of politics a bit sharp and sexy. This is exactly what happens. And I'm sure there are conversations taking place. Like, we focus on the Ulster meeting that was in Armagh last evening, but I am sure over the last couple of weeks that provincial councils have been meeting with county board officials to discuss voting intentions and what's going to happen around some of the motions this weekend.
Yeah, and you can see that the provincial councils are so embedded within the nuts and bolts of the GAA that their viewpoint is coming through in almost all of the newspapers. So it's clear that there have been conversations being had from the provincial council's perspective to put their view forward about what the issues are. And that is deeply ingrained in how the story has been reported from the start. And we've obviously offered all of the provincial councils the opportunity to come on and have a platform. We spoke this week with Leinster. We had Ulster on before. We haven't had any response from Connacht, but the opportunity for John Pretty to come on and talk to us is still there for us. And we would obviously offer Mr. Letty from Munster the same opportunity as well. But anyway, look, it's heading to squeaky bum time now. We're still waiting from word from a few counties: Galway, Roscommon, Cavan, Donegal and Monaghan.
Yeah, I think our producer Tommy Rooney has been firing off text messages around the country this morning to try and get what that decision may well be for some of those counties. We tick down to, 72 hours or so to go before the vote. And so far, we've kind of been conservative enough in the mapping that we've done ahead of this, where anything that I've put down as green or blue on the graphic that I put together was based on what was endorsed at a management meeting this week. Because in some cases, say, there's been discussion that a county is going to vote in a certain way and then they hadn't held their county board meeting until this week. I think until you've got that very firm mandate which has been handed to their delegates, we're still in the realm of speculation. But based on the amount of counties where we've not had a firm decision just yet, it's intriguing to see where some of them are going to go. And you've got to remember that the provincial councils, central council, the overseas boards, you know, various other committees that have votes at this upcoming special congress, they will also count. So just because it looks like there's a lot of green that's on the board currently with county board delegates who are going to go, that doesn't tell the full story. And ultimately, it's about getting to a 60% mandate if any of the proposals to be passed this weekend. So it's not 50-50. 60 is a big ask.
And the players vote, obviously. What number of delegates do the players, the 80% of players who voted for this in favour of the GPA, how much weight do those votes carry, Will?
Well, I think ultimately the GPA have, they have the equivalent of one county, I think, with delegates that go for this weekend. We need to like double check 100% how many votes
John's
they're actually going
two
to
counties.
Have.
John's got the two fingers up.
It's a two counties. So like it's still a very small percentage.
Two votes.
Yeah, so that's an incredibly small percentage. Now, like, the players are going to have an influence, and you know the GPA have been lobbying particularly hard over the last couple of weeks to try and convince as many county board delegates to vote for Proposal B as possible. But whatever with the soft power that's available from there, their actual vote is extremely low.
It's remarkable that the players have two votes in this. The entire constituency is, what, 180, John?
183. And Will, you've got your Irish map and your John King, and it looks fantastic and everything. But I suppose you almost need a world map for this, because there are other elements of the association. 19% of the association have votes. Hertfordshire have a vote. London have a vote. Warwickshire have a vote. Gloucestershire have a vote. Lancashire have a vote. Yorkshire have a vote. Scotland have a vote. Europe have a vote. New York have a vote. The USGAA have a vote. Canada have a vote. Australasia have a vote. Asia have a vote. The Middle East have a vote. On the football championship.
I guess at some level it makes sense to have a broad coalition voting on most of the things that matter. But given
the votes are the same from a lot of these areas as the counties that are participating in the championship and will be affected by the championship.
They're all way more important combined than the player's voice. Like, I don't know how many you listed off there. Was it
a lot of shares?
Of 183 votes, 34 of them are from overseas, 19%. 52 votes from Central Council. That is
17 times more important than the voice of the players.
So 47% of the vote is either Central Council or overseas. I got a WhatsApp from somebody who's the PRO of an overseas body that has votes in this on Saturday. And there was very little real discussion on it. We'll know tomorrow on the vote. And this is from an overseas body that has a few votes on Saturday.
A few votes. Some of them have a few votes, right? That's interesting. And sorry, they'll know tomorrow because they're going to be told by. So we should stress that actually,
I would say that in some of these bodies, often there's a very dominant figure in the body.
Well, I was going to ask. So today at noon, there will be a briefing.
Mm-hmm. Tom and Larry.
Okay, so the director general and the president of the GAA are going to give a briefing, and this is a on the record opportunity for everybody to ask questions about where their view on this matter lies or rests, and also what amendments they might be tabling to this before it goes to the vote at the weekend.
Yeah.
Is that what the overseas bodies are waiting for? The nod from Croke Park to say, yeah, this or no? Is that what we think?
I don't know that. I would say that overseas bodies, by their nature and framework and construct, are very close to Croke Park, because what is an overseas body there for? It's to promote Gaelic games overseas and to spread the gospel of the Gaelic language to people around the world that don't know about Gaelic games, but also to Irish people that need to get into communities abroad. So from my chats over the years with people from various county boards, they're very close relationship with Croke Park, as they should. So therefore, I do think that whatever the Central Council vibe will be,
they whatever follow that.
Will be very much in line with what the overseas people do.
Okay, so just to give us that again, so 19% of the 183 yeah. will be overseas.
Yes.
How many do the 32 counties of Ireland have?
I'll just do the math here. So
well, give us everybody else, and we'll by the elimination game we'll get there.
Yeah, no, I have it here. I have it here in just a second. So 34 plus 52 plus 7. So
7 is the ex-presidents.
Yeah, 186 minus 183 minus 93. math was never my strong point.
I thought you were beating the bookies with your...
Yeah, but like when you're beating the bookies, you do like pen and paper. I'm doing this off this phone calculator. So less than half. Less than half is the counties. 90 out of 183 is the counties.
Okay.
And in reality, the player's voice should be represented through those counties. That should be how this thing works, that they are mandated, sure, by the county board, but there should be a significant player's voice within those county boards who are mandating the delegates as well. Of course, that's not what's going to happen, and a lot of the players' voices are going to get ignored.
All right. Will, is there anything else? I mean, this has been a remarkable morning where we've learned that you've been an attendee at some of the most interesting of all of the congresses as a voting delegate. But notwithstanding that, the news is that we now have coast-to-coast support from Cork to Down. There's a clear seam up through the middle of the country that is turning green this morning. We're waiting for Ulster Says No to start flashing red at the top, and maybe there's a bit of red and maybe there's a bit of green in Mayo, ironically enough. We'll wait and see, and maybe they won't vote as a bloc. But is there anything else you think we need to know from the numbers or what we're waiting for?
Yeah, well, look, they've completed blockbusters by going coast to coast with the green line that's going across the country currently. It's perhaps significant that I think is that Kildare are the only current Division 1 county who have declared that their 4 proposal be at this stage. There's a lot of Division 2, 3, a couple of 4s there who are going towards green as well. Like, you have such a Division 1 power base, which is across Ulster and then back across to Mayo at the tip of Connacht there as well. So they're kind of the intriguing ones. I'm wondering where Dublin are going to go. Like, you had Declan Darcy on yesterday, who was, you know, a member of 5 All-Ireland winning teams as a coach, and, you know, previously had played for Leitrim too, and he gave a fairly strong indication that, you know, Dublin would be interested in voting yes towards Proposal B. And Brian Howard's comments in the media this week as well indicated they might go that way. We're waiting for a few more Leinster counties to come in, but it seems that Leinster and a lot of the Leinster teams are playing in lower division 2, 3, 4 are going to vote towards yes, and then the red line is likely to be west of the Shannon and then north of Leinster. But Down, I still think, lads, is a very significant switch towards yes, but you would imagine that if yes is going to win, almost all of those Leinster counties would have to turn green, and the rest of Connacht and maybe even Mayo would have to flip. And like, when you look at the comments which are coming out of Mayo, that seems fairly unlikely. My personal read on this, as we're here on Wednesday morning, is that Proposal B will probably be defeated. Proposal A will probably never go to a vote. And a lot of the ideas around a league-based championship and maybe divorcing the provincials from the All-Ireland Championship will be factored in when it comes to championship reform from the 2022 season on. I think we'll probably end up with the status quo for next year.
Yeah.
And either by way of some kind of amendment or what John Horne has suggested, a trial run over a 2 or 3 year period but postponed for next year, that a lot of these ideas will probably be factored into whatever we see for championship, say, 23 to 26.
I don't know. I think the league-based championship, this is our one chance to get it through. The breaking of the link with the provincial is now or never, and if the provincials win this, we're going to end up with the provincial round robin. That's my prediction. If Plan B doesn't happen this week, you're going to end up with a provincial round robin, which is, as I said on the show, officially a pig's mickey yesterday. Well, good stuff. Cavan, we're hearing, have a management meeting tomorrow night to discuss, same as Wicklow. The word is Roscommon are blue and they might have a free vote, but nothing official on that yet, so we're going to keep a close eye on this, and obviously we'll be bringing you the news of it on Saturday afternoon. John, anything else?
Not really, just apart from the sports news last night that Liverpool won 3-2 against Atletico, which was a breathless game. Man City won 5-1 in Belgium against Brugge. United and Solskjaer, huge game for them tonight against Atalanta in the Champions League, with Chelsea against Malmo. It's really about this vote. Central Council's makeup is interesting for me. The 52 votes and the kind of the vibe and the temperature of that is definitely going to be probably the decisive factor, I think, in this vote on Saturday. But
that's where the provincial council's power base is.
I would agree with you that I would find nothing more depressing than a provincial round robin in football going forward, and the province is getting more power and having these competitions that have no life and no imagination. It would just be really a slap in the face to go from potentially having this, just being very, very close to this happening, to having provincial round robins. Like, you just turn off the telly until August. Actually, by the time you get to August, the club season will be underway.
The provincial council power base lies there in terms of direct votes, but we also need to remember that the provincial councils have power in every single county around Ireland, whether it's the hand on the coffers or whether it's the county board people who want to progress onto provincial council level and are playing the political game themselves. So that is a huge knock-on impact from the soft power, I guess, from the provincial councils as opposed to their direct votes.
All right. Good stuff, John. Thanks for that.
All right, lads.
More from John across the course of the week on otbsports.com and, of course, live on Saturday afternoon and Off the Ball on News Talk as well. It is 8:45. I'm delighted to say Mark Lawrenson is with us this morning. Mark, good morning to you. You must be a bit wrecked. You were actually at the game last night, but you're already back in Liverpool.
I'm wrecked. Not a bit wrecked. Total wrecked. Got in. I got to bed about 3:45 this morning, so. But I got back straight after the game, which was fabulous. I got a lift, in inverted commas, from... it's like some of the officials of the club, etc., and the under-19s who obviously had played Atletico Madrid in the afternoon. So it was all good. Me and Jason McAtee, a couple of glasses of wine on the way back. Happy days.
Nice. And I was going to ask, what is the atmosphere on a plane like that, an official club plane on the way back after one of those massive European nights that seesaws ferociously and ends up in your favour?
Yeah, very, very, very good. Everybody was very pleased with themselves, although obviously we didn't do anything to help the team win. But no, it was all good. Yeah.
In the pantheon of great nights, where you're absolutely spanking a team and then you stupidly let them back into it and then you still win it at the end away from home, it's right up there, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely, totally is right up there. And in fact, I mean, I don't know if you've been to Atletico's ground, where you probably haven't had the opportunity, have you? And I think it holds about 50,000 to 60,000. And Atletico Madrid supporters are absolutely manic. They make an unbelievable noise. And Simeone, the manager, kind of conducts the crowd from the manager's position, from the trainer's position, and everything. And I mean, they every single tackle, it's like, you know, send him off this and all. It's really, really, really good. I mean, For Liverpool to come on top and get a win was obviously massive, because, as you said, it was... I mean, the first half was a game of two halves, you know, and obviously Liverpool started really, really well. Although, it has to be said that Atletico were missing two of their back three, two very important players, and that's why they looked a little bit kind of shabby to start with. And obviously then they got themselves back in the game, and Liverpool themselves also started defensively to look a little bit shabby as well.
When you analysed the game last night, Mark, I mean, Gerard kind of pointed to it there, letting Atletico back into the game. Is that exactly what happened from Liverpool's perspective, or do Atletico deserve huge credit?
No, I think Atletico deserve lots of credit. And I think what basically, you know, Atletico are a very physical team. You know, they love the challenges, they love the tackles, but they just sat off Liverpool. I mean, Simeone was doing his absolute nut on the sidelines. And then, at 2-0 down, one of his players made a great tackle, and that seemed to kind of raise everybody together. And then they got a goal, and getting that goal just after that tackle, as strange as it seems that a tackle can make all that difference, but it really seriously did. And getting the goal, and all of a sudden, I mean, they could have gone in at half-time, they could have been 4-2 up. Liverpool had a real problem because Naby Keita played really, really narrow. He was on the right of the three in midfield, and Carrasco, who started sort of left wing back for Atletico Madrid, and Lamar used to play at Monaco. They basically just attacked Trent Alexander-Arnold, and he didn't have any help whatsoever. And then Matic was getting dragged over, and they really posed Liverpool many, many problems. And it took a while for Liverpool actually to sort those problems out. I mean, they got it back to 2-2 when Griezmann got through. And we all thought he was offside because he was that far in front of everybody. And he should have scored. I mean, Alisson made a great block. But it was just one of those games. You go in at half-time and everyone goes, wow. And then the second half, it was just as good. Griezmann got sent off. And, first look in real time, he looked a little bit unfortunate. I don't really think that he saw Firmino. He just kind of put his foot up. But because it was high and he caught Firmino, the referee just sent him off. Then they went apoplectic, the supporters. Simeone was going nuts. And it was honestly, it was like the Colosseum for 15 minutes, or what I would propose the Colosseum was probably like, apart from the fact nobody got eaten. But it was just brilliant. It really, seriously, it was just like rock and roll. It was just such a fabulous game. It's a long time since I've been to such a game that's got so many talking points.
It lived up to all the hype, the pre-match, because so many of these games end up being kind of drab nil-alls. Not anymore, really, and not with this Liverpool team. Can I just ask you about Keita's role and positioning? Obviously, he gets whipped off at half-time.
Yeah.
Was he doing what he was supposed to do? Was it that Klopp misunderestimated what the consequences of playing him in that was going to be?
I think so. For once, I think Jürgen got it wrong. Just got it wrong a little bit. You know, he wanted to play narrow because if you looked at Atletico, they sort of played with five at the back and three in midfield. But the two wing backs almost made it five in midfield at times. And I think Liverpool just underestimated how attacking they would be. If you remember when Atletico knocked them out, I mean, they didn't cross the halfway line for probably 75, 80 minutes, and all of a sudden two goals late on and they beat Liverpool and knocked them out of the competition. And I think there was a little bit of that with Liverpool last night. But I think Keita won't play at the weekend because Fabinho will play. And we were all surprised when we saw the team sheet that Fabinho wasn't playing because, you know, in that kind of battle that was last night, he's far more important to Liverpool. He'll get a foot in, he can pass it. He's very, very mobile. And I think Klopp basically, by pulling your man off at half-time, was admitting that we probably got that wrong a little bit. But listen, that's what, you know, that's where you're a manager and you sit there, stand there and you look at it and you change it. And the change worked for them, most definitely.
Do you play Keita in a big game in the future if you've got Henderson and Fabinho on the pitch with him?
No, I don't think I will.
Right.
You know, he's been there a long, long time now, Naby Keita, and you know, we saw his previous club. He looked a real, real player. Great eye for a pass. Get your goal as well. He just doesn't look the same. It just looks like he's never really come to terms with the ferocity, be it the Champions League or be it the Premier League. And many, many times, you know, you've looked at him and you kind of think, well, what actually did he do? Which is unfortunate because he's got undoubted ability. And I'm told in training he looks, you know, world class, but training's training and playing's playing.
So what is your sort of order of midfielders then at that point? So assuming Fabinho and Henderson obviously start, I'm guessing Curtis Jones is number one, but what's the rest of the order there for that third midfielder spot in your view?
Well, Henderson will always be in there, won't he? And you know they throw Milner in really tight games because of what he does and his workload. But I mean, you know, the three in midfield would be, with what's available, would be Henderson, Curtis Jones for me and Fabinho. Mm. And I tell you what, last night's show to a lot of us was that how much they miss Wijnaldum, who's peeved obviously at PSG, but he's gone for the dough and he's not going to come back. So such is life.
But who would be your Jones is obviously injured at the moment. Who's your next man up after Jones then in that midfield three?
Well, I mean the list is there's quite a few, Oxlade-Chamberlain, etc. But there's nobody really that kind of stands out that you go, get him in the team. But, right. You know, I think the thing with them is I'm not, somebody was saying last night, I mean, the number of times they've scored three goals away from home already this season is phenomenal. So, you know, and they've won games far easier. It was just, I think it was a little bit of a reminder that, you know, at that level, you know, the real, real top teams, which undoubtedly I think Atletico Madrid are, and they'd probably, I would thought, go on and win La Liga. It's you've got to be on your toes. And sometimes, you know, you don't have the ball for a while. And I think that was a little bit strange for Liverpool yesterday, where they didn't have the ball for long periods and they just had to sit in and basically try and be solid. But they weren't, unfortunately, for for half of the first half, certainly.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see if the individual mistakes that Keita made is something that gets replicated across the season, or if that's automatically fixed when he's not on the team. I just do want to take a second to pay some tribute to James Milner here, who's 36 next January. He's getting picked for the away game against Atletico Madrid in the Champions League, and he's getting picked in midfield at this stage of his career. It's absolutely remarkable stuff.
Yeah, well, apparently his figures in training and everything, his stats, I should say, are sensational, the boys say. But he's, when you look at him, and I'm not being disrespectful here at all, he's a good, steady, solid player. He doesn't do anything particularly outstanding. You know, you watch him play and he's probably 6 or 7 out of 10, but he plays in all different positions. He's got unbelievable experience. He's a very much a calming influence. And I mean, now looking forward to kind of Sunday and Old Trafford, will Milner start? Because, you know, that was a tough game last night. And as you say, he's 36. But, oh, yeah, he's a pro's pro. And everybody loves him at that football club. They can't speak highly enough about him in every single way, on and off the pitch.
And everything you just said there about James Milner is probably adjectives that have been absent when Manchester United fans describe their midfield, if we're looking ahead to Sunday here.
Long may that continue.
He made his debut for Leeds in 2002. Next year will be, if he makes it to November 2022, it'll be 20 years playing in the top flight. In
sensational.
It is. And even when he's playing right back and there are smart, quick, fast players up against him, he still seems to be able to survive. So I don't know. I just think that...
Unless it's Phil Foden.
Well, it turns out nobody can do that, though. It turns out nobody can survive that.
No, not at the moment.
The recovery from last season is something else that we talked about a little bit earlier on the show. Was it just down to the fact that the central defenders were absent and that had a knock-on impact on midfield? Now that everybody's back, is it just as simple as that? Because the level they're at the moment is as good as anything they've been at under Klopp.
Absolutely, and the quality of the football and the quality of the goals, you know, are also outstanding. I mean, if you remember, they stuck Fabinho at the back, didn't they? And obviously, taking him out of midfield was a big thing. And I mean, towards the end of that, they just anybody turned up fit, and they were playing in the back four, weren't they? So yeah, it is as simple as that. But also, and I think we all know this, is that football is so different with a crowd. And I think the likes of Atletico Madrid, Liverpool, you go Man United as well, you know, massive effect on the opposition playing at those grounds against those teams. And we just, the noise last night from Atletico supporters honestly was sensational. It was a bit like being at Liverpool. It was like a European night where you felt like you're at Liverpool, but you're actually at Atletico Madrid. So it was just such a top game. And the thing I really, really loved was when the final whistle went and Simeone just cleared off, didn't he? He was never, ever, ever going to put his arms around Jurgen Klopp and say, well played, Jurgen. He just gave him the old see you later and I'll see you in a few weeks.
I know we're all supposed to be disgusted about the lack of sportsmanship, but actually, you know what? A little bit of drama. This adds to the soap opera. Bring it on.
Nothing wrong with it. It's like, you know, Klopp kind of looked and sort of, I don't know whether he waved or whatever, but it was obviously thinking, F you, by the way. So now I love all that. It's passionate. It's fabulous, isn't it? And listen, generally after games, they all kind of, all these guys sort of get together and have a drink. I don't know in Europe whether that happens, but a majority of Premier League clubs will invite the opposition in for a beer after the match because that's the way that it works. Although, I text Moisey when they won at Everton at the weekend because it's obviously a massive win for him. And he went in it and he said, Rafa never invited me in for a drink. So that's because you nicked 3 points from him and they'd have the real hump.
God, he really did. Well, certainly his team certainly outclassed Everton on the day, didn't they? I mean, it was another Moisey masterclass.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, look, you know, I've told you boys before, he loves the players. He said they're absolutely fabulous and they work extremely hard. He says he could do with two or three more, but everybody obviously says that all the time. So he's had a massive influence on that football club. And it just shows you when you now look at Man United, if they've been able to stick with him, but there are obviously other factors that were a problem at Manchester United as well, losing three of the back four in the first 3 or 4 months. But, you know, if he'd actually given them as much time as Ole Gunnar Solskjaer had, who's to say where they would be at the moment?
Well, certainly there's a track record that you can establish between these two, and Moyes' recovery has been sensational. You bring up Man United there. It's an unbelievably difficult period that they're facing into, and they've got Atlanta tonight, obviously, at home. It hasn't been... Hasn't been a brilliant sequence of results to get to this point, so you're not immediately chalking in a win there. From Liverpool's perspective ahead of the game at the weekend, you have to go out trying to to kill them at this stage, right? Because it could set off a chain of chaos there that would knock off a rival for the title this season.
Yeah, absolutely. And listen, Liverpool can only play going forward. You know, that's the thing about them. And if you get the supply right to the front three, the regular front three, you know, they'll score. I mean, everybody knows Salah's been unbelievable so far this season. But the other two as well have really, I mean, Firmino started to look like the player that we knew he always was and has been. And Mane as well started to score with all his hard work. And they've got Jota. So, you know, why wouldn't you play that way? And it's just the interesting thing with Manchester United, because we're all sat on the outside looking in. But you look at Liverpool and you know how they play. And you could honestly, you know, in games sometimes you could close your eyes and you know where every player will be generally, because that's, you know, the pattern of how it all works, and it doesn't work any other way. But you look at Manchester United and you kind of think that there's no fluency. Who's actually supposed to be playing where? And as good a start as Ronaldo's made, he doesn't do any closing down. And, you know, it's all very well saying, I'll get the ball into the box to him and he'll score. But apparently he's, and I don't really do stats, but someone was telling me last night that he's the least pressure person in terms of pressurising the opposition in the Premier League. And he's 50% lower than the next guy above him, who I don't know even was. So you're then saying, we're only pressing with, nine, aren't they? Nine outfield players and one or two of them. And, you know, if you look at one or two of them, they don't really want to press. They just want to play when the ball comes to them. And it can be outstanding players, but there just doesn't seem a set pattern and kind of even a rigidity of Manchester United with and without the ball. It's like, well, a little bit off the cuff. But, you know, that was best Charlton and Law's day and obviously Fergie's lot. But that they're not anything like near those kind of teams at the moment.
If you're Cristiano Ronaldo on Sunday and your team is in possession of the ball, are you targeting Virgil van Dijk? Are you trying to tap into this idea that he's not back to his best?
You will be. But I mean, you know, and his movement's still good in the box, but it's getting the ball in there. And I think that Liverpool's plan against him basically will be to play as high up the field as possible. And maybe minimise the fact that, you know, in the box he comes alive. He's obviously, you know, great finisher, very, very strong in the air as well. So I think that would generally be the Liverpool plan. And just search for weaknesses elsewhere. Why he picked the team, certainly, Ollie, that at Leicester was strange, because he's top centre-back. Well, he didn't even look like he'd trained.
No.
You know, and he's a big unit, and he looks to me like one of those who needs to train and train really hard every day. And I think he just thought, I'll throw him in, he'll be absolutely fine. Well, he got absolutely torn apart. It was just, I mean, the second half, and I'm not being anti-Manchester United, but they were abysmal. And every time Leicester came forward, they looked like they were going to score.
So, just last one for me. Your mindset when you were playing up against a title rival in a game like this coming this weekend, it has to be very aggressive, right? It is the Klopp style, and you've talked about that. How does he make sure that they don't in any way take this for granted or miss the opportunity to really show?
He doesn't let them. He's on them all the time. I'm sure today. I'm not sure what time they travel back, but I'm sure he's had a little bit of a meeting, or he will have a little bit of a meeting, which will be good bits and bad bits. But he'll just remind them what's expected of them with and without the ball. And, you know, I mean, as we know, they press really, really well. They work extremely hard. The forwards have to buy into it. It's part of it. And if you don't, you know, you're off. So I don't think. I think he will obviously be absolutely delighted with the win, but I don't think he'll be telling them that. He'll just be saying, look, boys, you know, we're 2-0 up and we keep it 2-0 up to half time, and then they've got to start to take chances. And when I say chances, in terms of getting more and more men forward, and that's when you really do pick them off, especially if your front three are really clever and quick, which they are. So he'll be looking more for the first 20 minutes last night rather than the last 70.
It's going to be very interesting, whatever happens. Mark, great to have you with us. Thanks a million for getting out of bed for us. Cheers.
No worries. Cheers.
It's Mark Lawrence in there. Fresh off the plane back from Madrid, where Liverpool won 3-2 against Atletico last night, obviously. If you want to get involved, we'd love to hear from you. 0879 180 180 is the WhatsApp number. And Liverpool fans won't want to miss our very latest Cadbury FC roadshow. It is a doozy. We're going behind the scenes at Anfield with legendary striker Robbie Fowler. We're joined by Liverpool captain, Irish international Niamh Fahey, former Liverpool midfielder and physio Richie Partridge. It's all with thanks to Cadbury FC and their club partnerships, granting you behind the scenes access at the Premier League's biggest clubs, coming soon to OTB's social channels. So just make sure you're subscribed to our YouTube channel and you follow us on Twitter as well. Here's what's coming up on OTB Sports Radio today at 1 o'clock. OTB Gold is Michael Owen in studio talking about his life after football. Mount Rushmore is Donegal at 3 o'clock. Our retro panel is about addiction at 4. OTB Gold at 6 is Dennis Ogie-Moran, and OTB will be live tonight from 7. In a couple of minutes' time, we're going to be joined by Peter Stringer.
OTB AM.
It is 7 minutes past 9. You're very welcome back to OTB AM. Now, we're about to talk to Peter Stringer, Ireland's most capped scrum half with 98 Irish international caps, a proud Corkman with over 200 caps for Munster. He's now a certified personal trainer. His online fitness platform, Body Plan by Peter Stringer, which offers fitness training through tailored workouts, is launching this month. PeterStringer.ie is the best place to get more information about that. Peter, good morning to you. How are you getting on?
I'm good, Joe. Yourself? Very well, thank you.
Yeah, good. So this is a new business. It's very exciting. Were you busy coding away? Did you have to learn HTML and Flash and all that kind of stuff from the 90s?
I tell you what, I have an interest. I'm a bit of a tech geek when it comes to it. So I like to understand the workings behind everything. So look, this has been in the pipeline for, I suppose, a couple of years. It's something that, I suppose, coming out of rugby and the transition period that I had was all about, you know, keeping fit and, you know, training, my nutrition. This was the natural progression for me to be able to apply it to a business, be able to apply it to other people's lives, and to add a little bit of support to, I suppose, busy executives and also kind of sports people as well. So it's a nice little model, and I'm very excited about it, you know.
It's a good time to be getting into this. I think particularly post-pandemic, people are very conscious of the fact that they need a work-life balance and they actually do need to look after themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I think I've noticed this particularly since I retired, meeting a lot of people in terms of, you know, busy lives, you know, business people who are on the move, people are going to get back out in the cars, they're going to be stuck in offices, maybe at home, and they need to find a little bit of a plan. And for me, coming out of rugby, it's all about that scheduling, sitting down on a Sunday night, getting your schedule in order, because you meet people and it's a case where people say, oh, I might go to the gym after work. It rarely happens, you know, Ger. So it's a case where if you put it in like any other meeting into your week, then you become accountable for that and it becomes a little bit more difficult to go away from that. So again, look, people are looking to get back into gyms, looking to get back into that fitness thing because people have been stuck at home for the majority of their time. And just to be able to help people with scheduling and getting things in place is why I'm here.
Was that a challenge for you at all, Peter, after retirement, given that you are now in control of your own fitness regime? There wasn't coaches in the province or in the national setup looking after you and giving you this regime all the time?
No, actually, I found it actually okay because the last 5 or 6 years I was, I suppose, obviously being in the UK, I suppose being written off and not offer of a contract here in Ireland when I was probably 34, 35 years of age. And I probably took it on board, you know, for myself to make sure that I was in the best possible shape, that I ate well, I trained well. And I did probably more training. I looked after myself better in those last number of years than I would have when even when I was in Ireland. And I would have always been careful of my approach to my training and my food. But I think in the last number of years, that gave me that kind of that extra impetus to be able to do it when I finished. I think a lot of guys probably struggle when they come out of the game. You've got, like you said, S&C coaches, nutritionists, all these people who are laying everything on the line for you day to day. You're told where to be, you're told what to wear, you're told what to eat. And I think guys somewhat struggle when they come out. But for me, I probably had that in place in the previous 5 or 6 years. I always had a love of kind of, I suppose, that nutrition side of it and understanding what food did for my body. So again, I found that a little bit easier. Obviously, two young kids can throw things up in the air and it's not easy at times and lack of sleep. But you write it down at the start of the week and you try and factor it in. It becomes a little bit easier. So it's just helping people kind of around that, and the scheduling is what I kind of love doing, you know.
I think a lot of people find that interesting. So every Sunday evening, you sit down with a pen and paper and plan out your week. And I presume it's fairly uniform, or how does it work for you?
Yeah, it is. And I suppose the last number of months, probably have been very, very busy, look, with this business and also opening a gym in Cork as well, and, you know, doing a lot of kind of the punditry as well. So it's, things have been busy, and again, family at home and trying to kind of spread that time around. But, you know, you try and get your meetings in place the week before, so you've got your diary, you've got it written out in your phone, whatever it may be. And again, you sit down on a Sunday and you can factor in where, you know, where you can kind of get your training sessions in. And again, if it's written down, it's like any other meeting, that an appointment comes up on your phone, it flashes up that you've got that time allocated to it, and it becomes a little bit easier to get off the couch, get away from your desk and go and do it. Because, you know, like we're all busy, everyone's busy. So it's, you know, like I said, when it's something at the back of your mind, it rarely gets happened. But if it's there right in front of you, it's becomes a lot more difficult to turn off that notification on the phone and not do it. So it's, it's something I'm obviously passionate about. It's something I have worked very hard at over the number of years in terms of my fitness. And it's got me to where I am today in terms of playing till 40. I just want to continue that till, you know, right throughout my kind of my life as it is, you know.
Were you a fitness fanatic as a teenager? Where did it come from?
Yeah, I always was. I suppose I found myself 7 or 8 years of age just randomly going for runs in the evening, kind of after school, and going to the pool and wanting to get fitter. And just, I don't know what it was. I suppose I had this inherent thing growing up that, you know, again, that the kind of size issue when you're playing and people just kind of write you off. And I always wanted to try and find something that would put me ahead of other people. And that was an area where, like, my fitness and obviously working on my skill set in rugby, you know, I was never going to be the biggest. I was never going to be the strongest. So in terms of, you know, you back your fitness and you back your skill set. So it was always about finding an edge for me to be able to compete with other people, that when coaches or whatever, you know, would look at me, they'd say, okay, look, this guy's the fittest, or this guy has got the best pass, we're going to pick him. So I had to find what worked for me and what I was good at. So I made sure that, you know, I was the best at it. So yeah, I worked hard at it. I worked hard, and it was always kind of in the back of my mind to kind of probably, I suppose when you've got that chip on your shoulder, you want to prove people wrong. So it's, it's kind of stuck with me from day one, you know.
And on the nutrition side, was it the same thing? Was there a full-time nutritionist at Munster when you began?
Not when we began. It was very kind of in its infancy in terms of, you know, what we were eating. It was all about your standard chicken and pasta. And then when kind of protein became a big component of in and around kind of weight training and recovery, and, you know, nutritionists would come on board then. So, yeah, look, I studied chemistry in university, and I always had a love from that side of things as well. But also when nutritionists would tell me, you know, this is, you know, take this, I always kind of questioned as to why, what it was doing for me and my body. Other people were just kind of, just give it to me and I'll take it, and not kind of really worried about kind of, you know, the effects, you know, protein might have or fats or carbs. But I always had a huge interest from that kind of biological point of view.
So were people like looking over at you in the players' canteen being like, what the hell is Stringer eating there? Or like, how did your nutrition actually differ?
Not that it differed, but it was right. Just kind of an understanding of kind of, I suppose, portion control. Obviously, you know, you've got John Hayes sitting next to me, and he orders in a restaurant, and the same kind of size food arrives out, same size plate, and you kind of work out the kind of the numbers then as you get older, and you kind of figure out, okay, look, obviously John Hayes is nearly twice my weight, but we're eating the same size food. So again, working out those numbers, what kind of you need from a kind of a dietary point of view on a daily basis, depending on your energy expenditure, all those kind of things. So I had a huge passion for kind of learning the fundamentals of it. So it was just about understanding the numbers attached to food and the values attached to food, which I think a lot of people struggle with today, where, you know, you might have a salad, but again, you put a few tablespoons of olive oil in a salad and all of a sudden you're up in 500 or 600 calories. It's trying to educate people on the values and nutritional values attached to food, which is a kind of a passion of mine, really, you know.
And was that something, because we had Paul O'Connell's studio recently and he was talking about that wasn't something that they fully understood, or you guys fully understood as a team, that information would come from various people within the group who kind of educated everybody as you went along until the scientists arrived and started to go, well, actually, you're different from everybody else. You need to behave differently from everybody else.
Yeah, right across the board in terms of food, in terms of your training. I think when I first started, obviously you're doing the same fitness work, whether it's a prop or scrum half or whatever. So you're doing the same fitness work, and that didn't really relate to what you did on the field. So again, the scientists came in, they analyzed kind of your meters per second and all of those things from a training aspect. And they were able to put pre-season programs in place based on your position. So all of those kind of things. And again, it came to food. You know, it was a huge kind of diverse range of players in terms of size, weight, needs, body composition, right throughout the team. So when you look at it like that, it's vastly different for everybody. So once the scientists came on board, I was hugely excited, and I suppose excited to learn about the aspects of what food does for your body and on a daily basis. You know,
were you tempted at any point to get into rugby, to work on this side of it, to be one of those professionals for future generations, or had you had enough of the game when you finished?
I wouldn't say that enough of the game. I still love the game. I still love being at the game. I love analysing the game. I love watching it, and I'm hugely passionate about it. And again, it was trying to find that area. Look, it might be something I go into down the line and more specific. At the moment, I've found myself people coming to me when I finish playing, and you know, kind of relations of mine, friends of mine, and kind of working for people who had a very, I suppose, poor understanding of food and I suppose how we're educated in school. And definitely I feel there's an avenue there for people. You know, when you're in school, it's one of those things that people should learn how to be able to cook for themselves and to be able to, like I said, understand kind of food values, because you leave home, a lot of people leave home and all of a sudden their diet, you know, goes out the window because they don't know what to do. And it's one of those life lessons that people really need. And in terms of professional sport, look, I'd love it. It's again, to be involved in that sphere would be brilliant. But at the moment I'm happy seeing change in people who aren't professional athletes. Doesn't matter if they're professional or not. It's a case where you can educate someone and you see change in someone and they take it on board, then that becomes rewarding. And from my point of view, that you kind of passed on that little bit of information.
One of the other things that Paul O'Connell said when he was in was he wasn't sure, given his weight profile when he was 16, 17, 18, if he'd have been guaranteed to get an academy contract. Now, I suspect that his competitive nature would have shone out anyway. But the point he was making was that his body size is now quite small for what the second rows in world rugby are kind of generally accepted to be. Likewise, I suspect that you might have a similar, it would have been your competitive spirit that was getting you through as opposed to your size and scale. Is there still room for a young Peter Stringer to play for Munster and to play for Ireland? Is Craig Casey proof that there is?
Yeah, I think so. I think if you bring a skill set that people can't, I suppose, avoid looking at, and coaches can't, you know, dismiss in terms of selection. Like I said already, when I was younger, I made sure that, you know, what I was good at, I made sure I was the best at it because of the hours that I practiced. And again, it comes down to that basic skill set, and you know, of being able to read a game, being clever about it, understanding the laws of the game, understanding the players around you, how they operate, being able to control guys around you, to direct forwards around you, which was a big learning curve for me coming from UCC and all of a sudden into the Munster setup where you have the likes of Claw, Golov, Axel, Quinny, these guys, and all of a sudden you've got to be the boss of these guys. So, you know, it's finding your voice as you become that player. And again, you know, from a physical point of view, you do what you can in terms of your fitness and your strength. So again, it's finding what you're good at, making sure you work really, really hard on it, because, you know, ultimately that's what's going to get you noticed.
That's a push factor. You're in your internal desire to be the best. What was the pull? Because it sounds like you definitely liked having a bit of a chip on your shoulder. Even, you know, there was a fairly offhand mention 5 minutes ago about being cast aside from Ireland when you were 34 and still playing till you're 40. So that chip was something that you carried with you, and it sounds like you nursed on purpose across your career.
Yeah, look, everyone, you know, no matter who it is, you know, if you hear a comment on the street about somebody or, you know, about yourself, you know, it weighs on you. And I think in today's society and social media and stuff, you know, obviously when I first started, we didn't have that. But again, you have comments from different journalists, from people, and you know, you take it on board. I was never one that I was outspoken at the time of when I was playing, and I never kind of made an issue of it. I dealt with it internally. I use it, you know, for my benefit, because it's what drove me on. Because, you know, when you're young and when you're a kid and you first start out playing, look, I got a lot of grief. My parents got a lot of grief for putting me out in the field from other parents. So again, all of those things, I have no doubt, I suppose, had this kind of factor, this kind of created this resilience within me. And again, it's about that proving people wrong and taking that with you without making a big issue of it, without making it kind of a public knowledge. But you use it to your advantage. You use it to kind of drive you on. And again, when someone puts you down and someone tells you you can't do something, what's the first thing you want to go and do is go and do it and prove them wrong. So it's something that, look, I've carried with me. I've used it as a positive. You know, I know guys certainly kind of struggle with comments when certain people kind of pass it their way. But, you know, I was fortunate enough that I went the other way and I was able to use it in a positive way, you know.
That's tricky, isn't it?
Yeah, it is tricky. It is tricky because I think inherently maybe there's an element of, you know, being born with a certain type of resilience and being able to add to it. You know, some guys certainly I've seen in the past and I've spoken to, you know, take things to heart, and you can see guys go the other way and go into themselves. And it's about being, you know, analysing. When I work with a couple of young scrum halves and, you know, just in a club scene and trying to bring that kind of confidence out of them. You see something in them and you try and work really hard and make sure that they know that they're good at something. So it's trying to get that kind of that balance with, you know, pushing someone, you know, to that edge to work really hard and using the negative thoughts that maybe they have and turn it into a positive way, because it's some people do struggle with it and it takes a little bit of time, but I think the rewards on the back of it, you know, you can see someone and they can actually use that. So anytime anybody throws those negative comments, you know, they've got this in the back of their mind, knowing that they can do something, they can push on.
Yeah, it definitely is something that some people are good at dealing with and learn how to deal with. And then, as you said, it can be the ruination of other individuals. Can we talk a little bit about the Ireland situation at the moment? Because we've all been fascinated with what's going to happen at the number 10 position. Johnny Sexton is the Ireland captain, and as it stands at the moment, is the incumbent. It'll be interesting to see if this hip injury is bad enough to keep him out of the Japan game and what happens. But likewise, we're kind of not really focused that much on the 9 situation, when actually it is as competitive and uncertain now as it has been at any point. Obviously, Conor Murray played really well for the Lions and looks like he is back to being our number one, but hasn't played since. So what's the scenario? What is the depth chart as it stands at the moment?
Well, the depth chart is pretty good. You look at the internal battles within Munster to an extent, with Craig Casey getting regular game time. You look at the battle for the number 9 jersey at Leinster. It's not a shoe-in, you know, in either of them. Again, you look at Ulster now with Nathan Doak coming on the scene, with John Cooney out. Guys have opportunities to play. And if they play well, they're going to hold on to that jersey. Again, Connacht are fighting as well with Blade and Marmy. So in every province, you now have two really, really good scrum halves. So there's a pool there of players that could push on. Obviously, younger guys with Doak coming through, you know, you'd probably think it's something on the horizon for them. But obviously, it's a little bit early, I think. But again, you look at that pool now and you talk about Murray. Like, you know, he'll obviously, I think, be involved this weekend for Munster, get him some game time. And then he's looking at Japan. So from my point of view, I think the fact that Ireland are probably, you know, undercooked going into this game, this series, compared to the Southern Hemisphere sides, you know, does Andy Farrell, you know, revert to a kind of a structured game plan, a game plan that they know, that they've worked over the last number of years? You'd love to have seen Ireland, you know, play, you know, in the summer in the States, and to just trying to develop some of those younger guys and get them a bit of an opportunity to play in a green jersey. So, you know, again, you look at the likes of Luke McGrath, again, and Jameson Gibson Park and Leinster. I think that's a real battle. And I think that, you know, it's a flick of a coin in terms of that Leinster jersey. But Andy Farrell, I think, you know, when you look at Jameson Gibson Park, and I've been really impressed with him anytime he's played in the Irish jersey. I think he adds something different. I think, you know, in terms of his all-round game, his kicking game, his attacking game, the way he can bring forwards into it. I think he's a good passing game. I think he adds another element, another dimension to Ireland's play. But again, it comes back to what type of game Ireland want to play. Do they want to have that structured kicking game? And obviously Connor's suited to that. I think he's that physical guy that we all know, and I think he has shown signs of coming back to where he was. I don't think he's anywhere close to it in terms of, you know, his ability to take guys on and have that kind of, I suppose, impotence that he has kind of around the fringes. But I think you know, but on the back of the Lions, I think he'll be the starting nine. But again, it's just about getting that game time in the meantime, and just trying to understand what Andy Farrell is trying to do with the team and how he wants them to play, you know.
As a test scrum half, how much exposure do you need and how many minutes do you need before you can feel comfortable at that level? And I guess what I'm asking here is, how soon do we need to be getting Craig Casey or Nathan Doak, as it may turn out, into one of these test matches and getting them meaningful game time?
Yeah, like, I think it's all well and good, you know, Craig Casey playing in the URC at the moment. And I suppose against teams where, if we're honest, you know, the Champions Cup is another step up, international is another step up. And I think to get guys ready for that international scene, we need to get them playing, absolutely. I think Champions Cup is the next step for a lot of these guys. You know, Craig Casey hasn't had much exposure at that level. Yes, he's had a few appearances off the bench. But again, a lot will tell in, you know, after these, I suppose, internationals and getting guys opportunities to play, which is, you know, we don't have those Champions Cup games to kind of put out those feelers for guys before these internationals, which is unfortunate, which may stand against a lot of these kind of younger guys, because that level that we go from a week in, week out URC into an international against Japan or the All Blacks to Argentina, whatever it may be, is massive. And I think, you know, it'd be unfair on guys, I think, to not have had regular Champions Cup action before we see them at international stage. Yes, there are outliers in every scenario, but I think for the most part, I think it wouldn't be suited for, I suppose, the guys to be in a position to play at an international level on the back of, I suppose, the quality games that we've seen so far.
So assuming fitness, you think it's going to be Murray and Sexton starting at 9 and 10 for the All Blacks game?
Yeah, I do. I see it like that. I think that's what Andy Farrell will go with. But I certainly see, as a nine, Jemison Gibson-Park playing a huge role across the three games. Again, you look at the Japan game. I think Ireland probably will want to go into it with a bit of a kind of a structured kicking game, because I think on the back of, you know, Japan, probably, you know, the type of game that they play, the last thing kind of Ireland want to do is go into their first international, throw the ball around, not be that familiar with each other. It's going to take a little bit of time, and having it a bit of a loose game, I don't think that's not going to be the plan. I think so. It'll be a case of trying to strangle the Japanese, because you look at what the way the provinces have been playing, particularly Munster and Leinster, and Ulster again to an extent, driving malls. You get into that 22, it's all that close quarter pick and go, and that kind of power game. So I'd expect to see a lot of that from Ireland in the opening game, certainly, just so that they get a game under their belt. And then, you know, who knows as the games go on, if we see a little bit of evolution, a little bit of, I suppose, expansive play. And I'd be wary of throwing guys in there, bit of a kind of an offload game, because against the Japanese you're gonna struggle if you give them any sort of loose ball, you know.
Yeah, one last thing on that is that there wasn't a whole heap of opportunity for all of the best players to be together many different occasions to implement a new game plan, so maybe everybody needs to rein their expectations in for this series of games.
Yeah, I'd agree. I, you know, as much as we all want to see, you know, free flowing offload rugby, expansive rugby, you know, and I think players within the provinces, I think we've seen glimpses of certain guys, I think, developing and evolving as players. But again, you'd like to see them carry that to the international stage. But again, I don't think we'll see it in these early games because of the opposition that we're playing against. And it's a time where, again, like you said, guys haven't been playing together. Guys are coming back from Lions duty, to come back from that into an Irish setup directly without having played alongside each other provincially for too many games. It's challenging. There's no way around it. And the only way you can get around it is getting these guys on the field and just figuring it out as they go through it, you know.
So just to be clear, the order is Murray is number one at the moment. Gibson-Park is a close second. Who's third for you at the moment?
I think looking at the squad, I think Casey's going to be in there. I think what he's done in the last number of months, I think he, you know, to have him as that third guy in the squad and to be seen as you know, the future. I think that's the way it's going to go, because to have him around the squad, I think, again, even though he might get much game time in the autumn games, to have him around, I think, you know, that's part of that learning process. Where guys, you talk about that step up from the URC, and the next best thing you can do when there's no games, you know, no provincial games on at that time, is to have him in that environment. So, I think Luke McGrath will be very unlucky. I think Caelan Blade will be very unlucky. I think to miss out if that's the way it goes, because they perform week in, week out, and it's just, again, it's a case of picking three out of like I said, you've got eight scrum halves who are potentially could be wearing a green jersey, you know, if not now, if in a couple of years. So, you know, who knows? And it's just so competitive. You look at the back row, you look at, you know, you know, you've spoken about it before, that right across the board, there is serious strength and depth if we can get a game plan in place that suits the players in those positions. I think it's exciting times.
Okay, one last thing I did want to ask you about was Ultimate Hell Week. I didn't see the whole thing, but anytime I saw it, there was angry people shouting at you, faces covered in spit and snot, exhaustion, yeah, heavy breathing. Was it enjoyable? Are you a masochist?
It sounds like you're describing a training session down in Musgrave Park at some point. But it was, look, it was grim. I'm not going to lie about it. And what you saw, like, I think they had to tone it down for television a lot. It was, they didn't really get across the aspect of our serious lack of sleep. It was 3 days before we got a half an hour sleep. We were probably eating about 400 calories a day. I was burning about 5,000 calories a day. So I lost 6 kg in 5 days, which I didn't really have to lose at that time. But again, it was just mentally more than the physical challenges. I suppose I prepared myself, again, as someone I'd probably live with regrets if I didn't prepare properly. But that physical aspect of training, you know, you knew there was going to be an element of a rucksack on your back, and that heavy weight going up a mountain for 5-6 hours, whatever it was. So it's the mental side of it. It's that day-to-day stuff where they're, again, like you said, shouting in your face, making sure that your water bottles are full. If they're not full, you get it over your head. So you end up being dehydrated for the 5 days because you're afraid to take a sip out of the water because they come in and check your water bottle and they put it over you. So it's all those little things where they're, you know, you can never do something. You never get praised for it. It's always wrong. And that's just part of the process where they try and break you mentally. But yeah, look, it was just something that my wife said to me. She said, look, I'm not seeing you till Sunday night. So that kind of gave me the motivation to kind of stay there and to kind of carry on. And you know, two young kids at home. She said, oh, I'd take Hell Week over it. I said, tell you what, it was hell. But something unbelievable to do something as an individual, I suppose, coming out of a team environment, team sport, probably, you know, the first thing that I would have probably achieved. Yes, there was a team element to it, but in terms of that experience and your own mental approach and your thoughts, you know, trying to battle those kind of moments in your head, was it was a very emotional experience and something that I'm delighted I did, but never ever do something like it again.
Okay, fair enough. And I suspect that there will be none of that in Body Plan by Peter Stringer.
not unless people want it, but it'd certainly be a much calmer approach, to be a lot more, I suppose, of a sympathetic ear, a lot more listening, and again, it'll be helping people. It won't be putting them through that much pain. There'll be a little bit of pain, but nothing like Hell Week. No.
Well, listen, when does it actually go live? Check out peterstringer.ie now. But when?
Yeah, it's live. It's live now. It's great. Live now. So people log on to peterstringer.ie and follow the process. There's exercise library there, well over 400 exercises, and fill out forms and I'll be back to them for training programs.
We wish you the very best of luck with it. Continued success. Peter, thanks for joining us. Cheers.
Cheers, guys. Thank you very much. Cheers.
It's Peter Stringer there giving us his thoughts on the depth chart at the moment, and obviously talk to us about his new business as well. It's 9:35 tomorrow morning on OTBAM. Andy Mitten about Manchester United against Atalanta. We'll bring you the latest ahead of Special Congress and much more from 7:30 as well. OTBAM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors.
OTB AM with Gillette. Put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.